Before introducing today's speaker, let me say a few words about the context in which this event is to take place. As some of you know, a student-initiated course was offered by the Peace and Conflict Program under the sponsorships of its five professors and myself on Palestine. The course was funded absolutely zero, not a single penny in it. That means during the 15 weeks, 15 distinguished scholars have been brought in locally from other campuses of the University of California and from other universities. These people are generous enough to contribute their time and effort, energy, to this without any compensation. And there was also a staff, the coordinator and the graduate students, or graduate teaching assistants, without whose effort and enormous investment of time and energy, this course would not have taken place. And let me point out these people. Jock Taft, the coordinator. Where is he? Ibrahim Muhawi. Avi Chomsky. And Nadia Yakub. Now, as I said, without these young scholars, this course, which registered 50 students and additional 100 auditors from time to time, would not have materialized, and this event tonight, too, would not have materialized. This evening, in other words, is the culmination of this course. Almost 20 years ago, Noam Chomsky was in Berkeley as the Beckman Visiting Professor of English, a world-renowned linguist, or some say the founder of the 20th century linguistics. He gave a course which, as I recall it, was jam-packed by faculty members as well as students from all kinds of departments, English, linguistics, of course, but from the other humanities departments and social science departments and even natural science departments. And of course, we are not surprised. We had known him for his universal interest and achievement. But we were ignorant at that time of the other side of Noam Chomsky. As the term went on, we began to see him engaged in various conversations at various spots, corners, nooks of the campus, talking with students, groups of various student leaders, at the plaza and everywhere else. And this aspect of his moral and political the commitment began to become apparent to many of us who are somehow, I suppose, in a backwood, I guess, compared with somewhere in the East Coast. As the term went on, anyhow, he was, as I recall it, one of the organizers of the first faculty peace demonstration in the Bay Area. That was in Port Chicago. That was the Navy depot, one of the greatest Navy depots, I think, for the efforts for the war efforts in Vietnam. And it is also in Berkeley where he, I think, completed the famous essay, The Responsibility of Intellectuals. That was 1966 or 67. People say nowadays that we are now living in the 80s, not in the 60s, by which they mean that even in Berkeley, good health and good cooking have replaced politics. I don't believe it. As I see you in this room, I can't believe that. I see many students on this campus, as passionately concerned with the Middle East, Central America, nuclear disarmament, all such things. And for those of us, books Noam Chomsky writes against all sorts of pressure toward a new Cold War or the Fateful Triangle, to name only the last two books, have been sources of greatly needed support and inspiration. 2 weeks ago, maybe some of you read that, The Nation had an article by Christopher Hitchin which asked why is it that Noam Chomsky's recent book, The Fateful Triangle, has not received a single book review, not even a negative one in the New York Times, in the New York Review of Books, The Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, the Wall Street Journal, the New Republic, or even the nation itself. We should ponder this question, since this question had something to do with Professor Noam Chomsky's talk this evening, U.S. Policy in the Middle East. Now, Professor Chomsky came 2 years ago to talk about four subjects in 2 days: the Middle East, Central America, East Timor, and nuclear disarmament. He came in today and has given already a talk. Gave a talk this afternoon and now this, and then tomorrow morning he's giving his time for a reception for the cause of Measure E. That is three activities in 2 days, and it is my great pleasure and honor to introduce and welcome him back to Berkeley, Noam Chomsky.
Well, as Masal just said, my last talk here on the Middle East was in late May 1982, and before coming, I looked up my notes just to see what I talked about that time, and amazingly, I had them, which is unusual, and could, even more amazingly, I could find them. It turns out that you remember the date. It was, I think, about May 20th or so, 1982. At that time, I began by reviewing the intensive Israeli efforts that had been underway in the past month to try to elicit some sort of PLO action, terrorist action, that could serve as a pretext for the invasion of Lebanon that had been planned from mid-1981. Now, at that time, talking about the planning and so on was in part speculation and putting it together from bits and pieces of evidence and so on, but now it's all laid out in great detail in the Israeli subsequent analyses by Zev Schiff and others. So I'll say it the way we now understand it, which at that time was only somewhat speculative. From July 1981 through June 1982, Israel was attempting in every possible way to elicit some kind of a PLO action, which would be interpreted in the United States, no matter what the circumstances, as unprovoked terrorism, and would therefore serve as a pretext for the invasion of Lebanon that had been explicitly planned since July, at least July 1981, and which the U.S. government knew about, as we now know, certainly from December 1981. One typical act of the several that I mentioned at the time was the bombing of Palestinian settlements in Lebanon, civilian settlements, in April 1982, in which several dozen people were killed. This, as I say, was in the hope of provoking PLO shelling of northern Israel in response, assuming that that would be regarded as unprovoked terrorism and would therefore justify the planned invasion. Well, this bombing of Palestinian settlements in April 82 was described by Israel as itself being a response to a provocation, to a PLO provocation. Namely, what had happened was that an Israeli soldier in a jeep had been killed when his jeep hit a landmine in southern Lebanon. That's a PLO provocation against Israel, which justified the Israeli attack against Lebanon, in which several dozen civilians were killed. Unfortunately, there was no Palestinian response to that Israeli terrorist bombing, but at least the United States' reaction to that was sufficiently disciplined and appropriate. For example, there was a reaction, an editorial reaction in the Washington Post, which is criticized as being biased against Israel and pro-PLO and so on and so forth. And here was what they said. They said, "This is not the moment for sermons to Israel. It is a moment for respect for Israel's anguish and for mourning the latest victims of the Israeli-Palestinian hostility." Note that that's the reaction to the Israeli bombing of Palestinian settlements in which several dozen people are killed. Notice that it's Israel's anguish that we must respect when still more Palestinians are murdered in an unprovoked Israeli terrorist attack. It's Israel's anguish that we must respect. And notice that the latest victims are not the victims of Israeli bombing, but rather of the more abstract Israeli-Arab conflict. Now, you might ask yourself what the reaction, and this gets directly to the topic of this talk, what the reaction would be if, say, suppose that there was PLO bombing of Israel, in which several dozen people were killed, which was taken in reaction to an Israeli provocation, namely a PLO guerrilla was killed in Israel. Okay, that's an Israeli provocation which would justify a PLO bombing in which several dozen Israelis would be killed. Imagine that that happened, and imagine what the response would be like in the United States, and compare that to the response of the Washington Post in this case, in an exactly comparable situation, in which we are to imagine that somebody had written after such a series of events, if it's imaginable, that it's the Palestinians' anguish that we must respect, and that this is not a time for sermons, and so on and so forth. That imaginary comparison tells you a good deal about the mood here. Now, I want to stress that this is standard. It's not unusual. In fact, I gave one example in answer to a question this afternoon. When Israel shot down a civilian jet over the Sinai, over the Suez Canal, in fact, in 1973, unprovoked killing of 110 people, refusing compensation or refusing any responsibility. There was no protest here. Golda Meir came a couple of days later and was received without comment. She returned with new military jets. There was an editorial comment. The editorial comment, which I sort of made up this afternoon because I didn't have my notes, I'll now read, from the New York Times, said, "No useful purpose is served by acrimonious debate over assignment of blame." You might compare that with the American reaction when KAL-007 was shot down under much more ambiguous circumstances, I might say. Or to come more towards the present, take, say, January 1984. In January 1984, Israel carried out heavy bombing around Baalbek, attacking several villages. The facts were reported in the press. There were about 500 casualties. A school was hit with 150 students in it, casualties. There was no comment at all about this. It was reported. The facts were reported, but it was not described as a terrorist act or anything of that sort. And again, you might imagine what would happen, say, if Syria bombed villages around Tel Aviv, killing with 500 casualties, attacking a school with 150 students killed or wounded. And imagine what the response would be in the United States to that. There would be, we'd be talking about the Nazis and the Holocaust and, a reversion to Hitler and so on and so forth. But in this case, there was literally not a comment that I could find. Not that the facts were suppressed. They were reported, but it was considered perfectly legitimate. No problem. Not a terrorist act. This, again, is very standard. I won't have time to go through the whole history. There's plenty of it. But let me just mention one case, which is interesting because of the context, and I'll, if this time, come back to the context. During the early 1970s, there was extensive Israeli bombardment of southern Lebanon, to the extent that hundreds of thousands of people were driven out of southern Lebanon and whole areas were destroyed and so on and so forth. One of them, which was particularly interesting, little of this was ever reported here, but when it was reported, it was just sort of matter-of-factly described. For example, when the Israeli shooting down of the civilian jet over the Sinai that I mentioned, I had just at the time of KAL-007, I went back to the New York Times just to see what they had said, and I noticed something I'd forgotten, namely the issue of the New York Times, which reported the shooting down of the Libyan jet, had an adjacent column in which it reported Israeli terrorist attacks in Tripoli, that's north of Beirut, where commandos had landed and killed people and so on and so forth. And this was just perfectly matter of fact, another, like a traffic accident or something of that sort. The case that I mentioned, speaking about now, was on December 2nd, 1975. That was an Israeli bombing, one of the many Israeli bombings of southern Lebanon. At that time, according to Lebanese sources, there were about more than 50 or 60 people killed in the bombing. Israel at that time stated officially that the bombing was not punitive. It was preemptive, not punitive. But that, again, elicited no comment. So there wasn't even a pretense that it was a retaliation. It was a punitive bombing. However, it did have a reason, we can imagine. The bombing did appear to be retaliation, not retaliation against anything that the PLO did, but retaliation against the United Nations, which a few days earlier had scheduled a session of the Security Council to debate the Israeli-Palestinian issue and had invited the PLO to attend and invited Israel to attend. And the topic under debate at that time was a resolution proposed by the so-called confrontation states by Syria, Jordan, and Egypt, which called for a peaceful political resolution of the conflict on exactly the lines of what has been a broad international consensus for many years, namely a two-state settlement with recognized borders and security guarantees and recognition of the right of existence and so on of every state in the region, including Israel, on the pre-June 1967 borders, that is, on the internationally recognized borders. This was vetoed by the United States, which has blocked every attempt at peaceful settlement since 1970. I'll come back to that history, but this was one of the cases. This resolution was in fact publicly supported by the PLO, but we later learned that it was in fact prepared by the PLO, according to Chaim Herzog, who is now Israel's president and was Israel's UN representative at the time. According to him, the resolution was not only backed by the PLO, which was public, but in fact prepared by them, and it was a resolution that called for a peaceful political settlement with the usual paraphernalia of UN 242, if you know it, security guarantees, territorial guarantees, and so on. Israel refused to attend the session. The United States vetoed the resolution, therefore guaranteeing that there would be no peaceful political settlement and that war and conflict would go on. It's very plausible to conclude, we don't have Israeli cabinet records about it, but looking at the conjuncture of events, it's plausible to conclude that the December 2nd bombing, which was preemptive, not punitive, was in fact a retaliation against the announcement of this session, which was to deal with a PLO-initiated proposal for a peaceful political settlement. That's about the only thing I can figure out. But again, all this went by without comment, and still without comment. In fact, the incident, the whole incident, including the U.S. veto of the U.N. Security Council resolution, that's down the memory hole in the United States. It's not mentioned in scholarly monographs. It's out of the histories. It's as if it's right down Orwell's memory hole, along with a whole lot of other things which are inconsistent with the official doctrine that the United States seeks peace and that it's the terrible Arabs who try to prevent it and so on and so forth. Anything inconsistent with that official doctrine is very unlikely to see the light of day in the United States. And this one, in fact, is so inconsistent with the official ideology that you won't even find it in quite good monographs, like Seth Tillman's book, The United States and Israel, which is sort of standard scholarly work on it, and it's quite good, but this one, this particular case, it excludes, doesn't even mention it, can't deal with it, that won't fit into the system. Well, that's an earlier case. Let's return to, let me say also that an interesting fact about Israeli terrorist acts is that they're not even regarded as terrorist or even mentioned at all when they're directed against the United States. That's kind of unique. And that tells us something special about the relationship between Israel and the United States. So, for example, in the early 1950s, when it seemed there was concern that there was concern in Israel that the United States might support Nasser. In fact, Nasser had CIA support, and the United States hadn't really settled on, you know, who was going to back and who was going to be its client in the region. And there was concern that it might turn out to be Egypt. At that point, Israel launched terrorist attacks, sent a terrorist gang into Egypt, which carried out terrorist attacks against U.S. installations, blowing up U.S. information agency installations, libraries, also attacking, blowing up cinemas and railroad stations and so on. They were caught, and it was exposed. U.S. intelligence knew all about it. The purpose of it was probably to make it seem as if it was an attack by Islamic fundamentalists and therefore to poison relations between Egypt and the United States. A more recent information, which is just coming out, suggests that there may have been another purpose. It turns out now that there were secret negotiations going on between Prime Minister Sharet, who was sort of the dovish prime minister in Israel, and Nasser to try to arrange peace. And the more hawkish elements in Israel, including David Ben-Gurion, the leading nationalist figure, who had in fact been trying to block peace since 1948, it's conceivable that that group may have carried out these terrorist bombings in order to block the negotiations which were then proceeding. That's speculation, but a lot of documentation is coming out about this now, and I think that's the way it's going to look when we finally have the whole story. In any event, these terrorist acts against U.S. installations were suppressed and forgotten. In fact, Stephen Green, who really recently investigated this and just wrote a rather interesting book about this and a bunch of other things called Taking Sides, and attempted to get CIA records from the Freedom of Information Act, said that he was unable to find any record, even on internal American intelligence, for about 6 years, until the issue became a public issue in Israel. It blew up in Israel for various reasons in 1960, and at that time there was a CIA assessment. But 6 years went by before there's even an internal intelligence record about Israeli bombings directed against American installations. And there was nothing. You know, the press had nothing, and in fact it's all, again, been forgotten in history. Or to take another case, take the U.S. Liberty. This was in 1967, during the 67 war, when an unarmed, basically unarmed, U.S. ship surveillance vessel was bombed by Israeli planes, napalm attacks, hit by torpedo boats. They machine gunned the life rafts to make sure that nobody would escape. There was no possible question about what the boat was. It was well identified and so on and so forth. There were about 35 people killed and 70 wounded. The facts were suppressed by a Naval Board of Inquiry. There were initial reports by the press, but then it quickly subsided. The crewmen on the Liberty were forbidden to talk about it. Years went by before the issue even became known, and now it's barely known, though the facts are sort of out, and they're kind of not in dispute anymore. Now, you might ask yourself, to understand the relationship between the United States and Israel, simply ask yourself, what other country could carry out terrorist attacks against American installations, say blowing up U.S. libraries, could attack and sink, try to sink, almost sink an American ship with 100 casualties, with napalm and torpedoes and machine gunning boats and so on, and do this with complete impunity, no response whatsoever, in fact suppression and apologetics, and then put that in the context of what other country could carry out things like, say, the January 1984 bombings around Baalbek, or many others, I just mentioned one or two, and do that with impunity, and what country could carry out bombings of the sort that Israel carried out in April 1982, just before I was here last time, and get the response in the Washington Post that I quoted, namely that it's Israel's anguish that we have to respect when Israel bombs and kills Palestinian civilians. Well, when you answer those questions, you'll learn something about to yourselves, you'll learn something about the U.S.-Israeli special relationship. The fact is that as an American client, Israel inherits from us the right of massacre and aggression, which we, of course, accord to ourselves, and that is somehow inherited by clients. And it's so extreme that even terrorism directed against us is tolerated under these special circumstances. That really is unique. You'll have to look pretty hard to find a relationship like that in diplomatic history, and it does merit the term special relationship, and I want to come back to what the reasons for it may be. Well, returning to May 1982, Israel's repeated efforts to elicit some sort of a Palestinian action which could serve as a provocation failed, so Israel had to, in fact, concoct a pretext. And what they did, this was about a week or so after I spoke here, was 2 weeks after I spoke here, they did concoct a pretext, namely on June 3rd, 1982, the Israeli ambassador to London, to England, was attacked, and there was an attempted assassination attempt carried out by a group led by Abu Nidal, who was at war with the PLO and had been condemned to death by the PLO 10 years earlier. But that was and in fact, who didn't even have an office in Lebanon. I mean, nothing to do with Lebanon, didn't even have an office there. So there's an anti-PLO group whose head had been condemned to death by the PLO, had been fighting a war with the PLO for 10 years. And that group did, in fact, attempt to assassinate Ambassador Argov, but that was used as enough of an excuse to attack Lebanon and attack the PLO. And that was accepted in the United States. That was accepted as a legitimate retaliation. So it's legitimate to retaliate against the Palestinians in Lebanon and against Lebanon because a group which is at war with the PLO and doesn't have an office in Lebanon attempted an assassination. Those are the facts, and that was uncontested facts, and accepted as legitimate defense in the United States, another aspect of the special relationship. On June, immediately after the assassination attempt, finally, here was the pretext. I mean, they sort of given up hope of getting any reasonable pretext. Here came one finally. So Israel attacked Lebanon heavily the following day. Sabra and Shatila refugee camps, later to be the scene of a famous massacre, were heavily bombed for 4 hours. with a couple of hundred casualties, according to American eyewitnesses there, including bombing of the Gaza hospital, which was later bombed again during the bombing of Beirut. Israeli commandos landed on the coastal road between Beirut and Sidon and opened machine gun fire on cars and buses that were traveling there, in which civilian refugees were fleeing from the south, knowing what was going to happen next. The government of Lebanon requested a Security Council meeting, and the Security Council, I'm now quoting the UN ambassador, Hassan Tweni, he called a Security Council meeting to stop the aggression against Lebanon, the wanton bombardment of positions in Lebanon by Israel. The Security Council did, in fact, call for a ceasefire at 6 a.m. June 6th, and Israel responded to that unanimous Security Council call by launching the full-scale invasion on June 6th, immediately after the time of the ceasefire. Security Council then again unanimously demanded Israeli withdrawal, but the attack continued. By June 8th, 2 days later, the United States vetoed a Security Council resolution calling for cessation of hostilities, and then the United States continued to block every effort without exception, to put a stop to the carnage, including mutual withdrawal and so on and so forth, a withdrawal back to the ceasefire lines. All those efforts were blocked by the United States, which continued to support the Israeli attack and to block any attempt to stop it. This went on right through the invasion of West Beirut in September, mid-September. The United States was still backing it through the invasion of West Beirut in violation of the ceasefire agreement. You take a look back at the statements, you'll find that. And in fact, the first real American response, which was something, even this was not more than rhetoric, which was least rhetorical, was after the unexpected international reaction to the Sabra Shatila massacres. At that point, everybody quickly ran for cover and said, no, this is terrible, this is too much. And the American government also did, although the American government again vetoed voted against the General Assembly resolution condemning the Sabra Shatila massacres, voted 147-2, the standard vote on these issues. But nevertheless, the United States did want to dissociate itself from the Sabra Shatila massacres weeks after the end of the war. Up until this point, full American support, occasional rhetorical objections, but the Israeli press reported, and quite plausibly, that even when there were public condemnations, Israel was being told privately at the same time to proceed and get it done with quickly and expeditiously and so on. That was the American involvement in that war. And I should say that with all the fuss about the Sabra Shatila massacres, in which hundreds or maybe thousands of people were murdered, the bombing of Beirut was a much worse atrocity, and what happened in southern Lebanon also was a much worse atrocity. That wasn't considered so here, but if you look at the facts, I don't think there's any doubt that that's the case. Well, I've talked a little bit about the pretext for the invasion, the concocted pretext for the invasion. What was the reason for it? What was the reason for the invasion? Well, there are a number of theories about this. The most plausible, in my view, was a theory that was developed by a man named Yehoshua Porat, who is a leading Israeli scholar, kind of a mainstream Israeli scholar, and in fact Israel's leading specialist on the Palestinians, probably the world's leading specialist on the Palestinians. He's the author of some multi-volume standard scholarly works on the history of Palestinian nationalism and so on. And he's not particularly dovish, sort of a middle-of-the-road, very respected and very good, in fact, Israeli scholar. In late June, a couple of weeks after the war broke out, he wrote an article in Haaretz, which is kind of more or less like the New York Times, you know, the sort of, I don't know, that kind of journal. It's kind of an insult to Haaretz, I withdraw it, but a very good, you know, that's the sort of the most, I don't know what to describe it as, you know, you can make it up. He wrote an article there, I think it was on June 25th, in which he explained what he thought was the real reason for the Israeli invasion. Nothing about, couldn't be peace for Galilee, it couldn't be protection of the northern settlements, because there had been, in fact, the PLO had not fired a pistol across the border for over a year. I mean, all of that was fabrication, and he recognized it. He dismissed the Argov assassination attempt as obvious fabrication, and he asked, what are the real reasons? And he said the following. He said that Arafat's scrupulous observance of the ceasefire was, I'm quoting, was a veritable catastrophe in the eyes of the Israeli government. The reason was that it then became difficult to evade a political settlement. The way in which Israel had been evading a political settlement for many years, I gave one example in 76, but there were many others, was by pretending that the PLO is just a gang of thugs and murderers, and how can we deal with them? But and that was pretty effective, at least in the United States. The battle had pretty much been lost in Europe, but nobody cares about Europe. That's just a colony. What they care about is the United States. And in the United States, the press and the intelligentsia were holding firm. They were keeping to the lies and the illusions, and the facts were still irrelevant. But even in the United States, things might begin to erode, as they had in the rest of the world, and therefore Arafat's ability to get the various, you know, warring factions of the PLO together to observe the ceasefire scrupulously was regarded as a veritable catastrophe in Israel, in the eyes of the Israeli government. That's Porat's response. And then he goes on as follows. I'm quoting. He says, "The government's hope is that the stricken PLO, lacking a logistic and territorial base, will return to its earlier terrorism. It will carry out bombings throughout the world, hijack airplanes, and murder many Israelis. In this way, the PLO will lose part of the political legitimacy that it has gained and will mobilize the large majority of the Israeli nation in hatred and disgust against it," and so on. That's what he suggests is the thinking behind the attack, and it's not implausible. It's a very reasonable analysis and probably a correct one. In fact, material that's appeared since on the part of the government tends to confirm it. So, for example, Prime Minister Shamir, in November 1983, on television, said that Israel went to war in 1982 because of a terrible danger, not so much a military danger, but a political danger. The political danger was the threat of being compelled to enter into a political settlement of a sort that they wouldn't want. Commenting on this again in Haaretz, the Israeli satirist B. Michael, who's a very good and quite conservative satirist, I should say, wrote an article in which was called "Thank God There Is No One to Talk To," meaning citing Shamir's remark and then going on and drawing the obvious consequences. Meanwhile, a much more acceptable history has been reconstructed in the United States, and remember, that's the only country that counts. For example, President Reagan, March 29th of this year, stated in one of his speeches, if that's the right word for them, I don't know, that Israel, he said, Israel went all the way to Beirut because of violations of its own northern border by the Palestinians, by the PLO. That's why they went all the way to Beirut. In fact, this lie, and notice that it's really worthy of Goebbels and Stalin, that lie, it's incidentally also constantly reiterated by the democratic liberals. You take a look at their statements. In fact, by now it's become standard that Israel attacked Lebanon, had to go all the way to Beirut because of the constant provocations on the border. In fact, the number of provocations was zero, despite extensive Israeli efforts to try to evoke some kind of a provocation. The efforts failed, but that doesn't matter. In a well-designed propaganda system, there were provocations even if there weren't any. You know, so there was constant shelling across the border, even if the actual number of shellings was zero, despite Israeli attempts to elicit them. Again, that's the way a really well-designed propaganda system works, one like ours. What I've really been asked to discuss tonight and will discuss now in this context is the American peace movement, how it's related to U.S. policy in the region, and we'll come to that. The peace movement isn't a membership organization, so it's a little hard to discuss. You know, you don't know who's in it. Anybody's in it who says they're in it. And, of course, everybody says they're for peace. You know, Hitler was for peace. So everybody's for peace. The question is, what kind of peace? But let's take what's usually called the peace movement. At the very least, the peace movement includes the people who are worried about, say, nuclear war. I guess that includes the peace movement. I will later talk about the peace movement reaction to the particular events I've just described, but let me put it in a more broader and more general context. Now, anybody who's not completely blind should be able to see that we are drifting dangerously close towards a superpower confrontation and towards nuclear war, and we have been for many years. Furthermore, it's also obvious, and in fact continually reiterated by people who write about the matter in some serious fashion, it's continually reiterated that the Middle East is the most likely flashpoint. There are very good reasons for this, having to do with oil and strategic reasons and so on and so forth. This is quite widely recognized. What is less widely recognized, but much more important for us to consider, and would be important for the peace movement to consider if it deserved the name peace movement, I think, is that U.S. policy has been instrumental, crucial and instrumental, in perpetuating and often, in fact, inflaming the tensions in the Middle East, not there alone, but primarily there, that have been brought us very close to superpower confrontation many times, and that will continue to until it finally goes off, probably in the not very distant future. It's done this by blocking the possibilities which have existed for many years for a peaceful resolution of the Arab-Israeli conflict. And the seriousness of that is quite apparent. Instead of giving you my opinion, let me quote from a recently leaked Air Force study called Air Force 2000. As far as I know, it wasn't reported in the United States, but it was reported internationally. According to this study, Air Force 2000, recently leaked a few months ago, the United States, I'm quoting, is much more apt to be drawn into wars involving third world nations than in a war in Europe where combat with Soviet forces is not likely in this century. Now, that's pretty obvious, and everybody who's thought about it has drawn the same conclusion. The study concludes that war is nearly inevitable in the Middle East by the year 2000. In particular, without a settlement of the Arab-Israeli issue, I'm quoting, without a settlement of the Arab-Israeli issue, war in the Middle East is virtually inevitable. The possibility of global peace seems remote. That's the core of the analysis, and then it goes on to say, in sort of Reaganite style, that if the massive exchange phase, you know, where we shoot off all our missiles at one another, if it's not decisive, the goal will be to terminate conflict as soon as possible on terms favorable to the United States. Okay, that's, you know, we can put that in the, you know, the lunatic box. But the other part is not lunatic, that there is likely, very likely to be an international conflict growing out of the unresolved tensions in the Middle East. That's highly likely. The Air Force study is quite plausible on that. What it doesn't mention, and what is suppressed by the peace movement too, is that American actions are playing a major role and have for many years played a major role in increasing the likelihood that that those tensions will in fact break out into nuclear war. In this respect, the peace movement is a major contributor to an ultimate nuclear war, and probably not such an ultimate one. Well, let me try to clarify that by bringing up a little history. There have been many occasions in the past years when we have come close to nuclear war in the Middle East. The first known one was 1950. Well, it was putting aside 1956, which is possible. The first major one was 1958. In 1958, the United States sent Marines to Lebanon. That was the first time we sent Marines to Lebanon. And Eisenhower wrote in his memoirs that there was a risk of general war. In fact, now that the background documents have appeared, we see that that issue was recognized at the time as a likelihood. Sending the Marines to Lebanon might lead to actions which would involve the Soviet Union and would quickly break out into nuclear war. In 1967, there's little doubt now. I mean, the evidence that's come out now is, I think, very persuasive. Not only that the United States backed the Israeli attack, but it also that it knew that Israel was under no military threat. We've known for years, though it's been sort of suppressed here, that the Israeli general staff knew that Israel was under no military threat. They'd already announced this by 1970 or so. But we now know that the U.S. intelligence also assumed that there was no possible military threat, so much so that, in fact, the Joint Chiefs apparently didn't even have contingency plans in case anything went wrong, which is very unusual. They knew, in other words, that Israel's military power was just overwhelming. And it didn't matter who struck first or whatever, Israel was going to win a huge victory. And it now turns out that the United States not only provided arms to Israel immediately before the invasion in violation of public commitments to remain neutral, but probably even participated in the war. Recent evidence indicates that American reconnaissance units may have actually participated in the war itself. It's another story. Well, the war did lead to a threat of international confrontation, a nuclear war. Secretary McNamara, who was then Defense Secretary, recently revealed that the hotline was used for the first time. That was known, but that Kosygin threatened war over the hotline. Now, he didn't give the circumstances, but it's possible to reconstruct what they probably were. Israel attacked Syria on June 9th. In the so-called Six-Day War, after the ceasefire. A ceasefire had been established. After the ceasefire, Israel attacked Syria. This was under direct order from Moshe Dayan, who apparently didn't even inform the cabinet about it. And at that point, the Soviet Union apparently did threaten military action. The Soviet fleet in the Mediterranean was set in motion towards Lebanon, and they were intercepted by the American fleet. So the two major fleets were in a situation of confrontation at the war's end, and that's probably what this occasion was about. Also, at the time of the bombing of the Liberty, the United States really didn't know it. The Liberty didn't realize at first who was bombing it. They knew it was under surveillance by Israeli planes, but they assumed that they were allies. When the planes came and attacked the Liberty, they came unmarked, and they weren't sure who was bombing them. They sent off a message to the 6th Fleet off Naples asking for air cover, and the 6th Fleet sent off nuclear-armed bombers under orders to use destructive force if necessary, not knowing exactly whom they were to attack. They could have attacked Russians, they could have attacked Egyptians, anybody. And that action itself could have set off a nuclear war. It was that close. They were called back on direct order from Washington, the nuclear bombers, and in fact the Liberty never did get air cover. It was reached by a Russian ship which tried to assist it before the 6th Fleet ever got there. That incidentally tells you something about the much lauded military communication systems that we're supposed to have. That was 1967. Again, at least two cases there when we came unpleasantly close to a nuclear confrontation. In 1973, the United States called a strategic nuclear alert at the end of the October War. And again, there's no doubt that there was serious danger of nuclear war at that time. But there's something more. Here we get to the core of the matter. What ought to be brought out and understood about the 1973 war is that the very fact that the war took place is primarily an American responsibility. In fact, it's Henry Kissinger's the person who bears almost personal responsibility for the October 1973 war and the oil crisis that arose afterwards and so on and so forth. This was really his personal contribution among many. You can see that if you look back at the history. Again, we have to look at parts of the history which have gone down the memory hole in the United States. Kissinger took over American policy toward the Middle East in 1970. Now, up until that time, the official American policy, and theoretically it's still the official American policy, had been that there should be a settlement on the pre-June 67 borders with insubstantial alterations along the lines of the international consensus. When Kissinger took over, that dropped. He supported Israeli occupation of the occupied territories, and that's been effective operational American policy since. Now, in 1970, Nasser made a fairly clear proposal for a political settlement, normalization of relations, no response from Israel or the United States. In late 1970, Sadat came into office, and in February 1971, so 6 years before the trip to Jerusalem that made the papers, Sadat offered Israel a full peace treaty. Full peace treaty in exactly the terms that corresponded to the American official position. That is, a settlement, political settlement on the pre-June 67 borders, territorial guarantees, normalization of relations, security guarantees, the whole business. And interesting, at that time, no mention of the Palestinians. So no Palestinian state, nothing of that sort. That was in terms of the international consensus of the time, which didn't regard the Palestinians as anything but a refugee problem. That was Sadat's offer in February 1971. It was recognized by Israel as a genuine peace offer, but rejected, and the United States backed Israel in that rejection, and that was the end of that one. In fact, it's out of history, too. When Sadat was assassinated, you take a look at the obituary, the two-page obituary in the New York Times, not a mention of it. What it says is that Sadat was a typical warlike Arab who wanted to kill all the Jews, and he tried in 1973, but finally, under the kindly tutelage of Henry Kissinger, he was taught to be a man of peace, and then he went to Jerusalem, and he's a great hero. That's what's reported in the New York Times. Nothing about what actually happened, namely that Sadat offered peace in February 1971. It was blocked by Kissinger, and then after repeated threats that if the United States continued to block any peaceful settlement, he would be forced to go to war. Sadat did go to war in October 73, and then Kissinger finally saw the light and agreed to some sort of settlement. That's what really happened. But that's down the memory hole. And, for example, Sadat's February 71 offer and Kissinger's rejection of it is not even mentioned. In contrast, if you go to the Israeli equivalent of the New York Times, Haaretz again, in the obituary the same day, not only is it mentioned, the February 71 offer, but it is described as the famous offer, famous offer by President Sadat in February 1971. Well, that's Israel. This is the United States. Here, it's not only not famous, but it didn't exist because it doesn't fit. You know, it doesn't fit the right image. That was February 71. Jordan also made a peace offer in February 1971. There was no response at all to that one. In 1972, Sadat kicked out the Russians from Egypt. No response to that. Jordan also made a further offer in 1972 for a settlement. Israel's response to that was to declare that the historical connections of the occupied territories in Israel were indissoluble and so on and so forth. This was the Dovish Meir government, I should say. Nixon and Kissinger throughout this period were being constantly warned by oil companies, by diplomats, by American ambassadors and so on, that if they continued to block any Arab peace offers, such as Sadat's offers and Jordan's offers, then that was going to necessarily lead to war. If you block every proposal for peace, then ultimately they're going to have to go to war. That warning came constantly. It was dismissed, and finally, in fact, the October War broke out, Kissinger's War, as we ought to call it, with all the consequences that ensued. Now, that's what actually happened, and again, the facts are uncontested. The facts are clear, explicit, uncontested, and unequivocal. It's particularly interesting to see how Kissinger describes them. He more or less admits them, in a way, in his memoirs written 10 years later. That's very interesting. Let's take a look at his memoirs. In his memoirs, in fact, he takes great pride in the fact that he blocked every attempt at peaceful settlement. The way he puts it is this. He says that he succeeded. In fact, what he takes pride in, I should say, is that he succeeded in overcoming what was, in fact, his major enemy at the time, namely the State Department, if you read the memoirs. Most of the memoirs is a study of the struggle between Kissinger and the State Department, you know, that great threat to his personal power. And then there were some secondary things like the Russians and so on. And he succeeded. He succeeded in this battle. He succeeded, he says, in maintaining what he calls stalemate, the policy of stalemate, meaning rejecting the various opportunities for peace, such as Sadat's. And then he gives his reasons for this. And the reasons are worth listening to carefully. I'm quoting the memoirs now. He says, his aim was to produce a stalemate until Moscow urged compromise, or until, even better, some moderate Arab regime decided that the route to progress was through Washington, until some Arab state showed a willingness to separate from the Soviets, or the Soviets were prepared to dissociate from the maximum Arab program, we had no reason to modify our policy of stalemate. Okay? Let's think what that means. This is, in fact, one of the most amazing documents in diplomatic history, I think. The fact is that even an imbecile should have been able to perceive that at least one Arab state recognized that progress had to be through Washington, namely Egypt, because Sadat had been making it clear and explicit and no questionable terms that he thought that, in fact, he said Washington holds 99% of the cards, we've got to make progress through Washington. But couldn't get through to Kissinger. And in fact, even 10 years later, he doesn't understand it. Now, not only did he not understand it at the time, but even 10 years later, he still doesn't understand that there was an Arab state insisting that the road to peace had to be through Washington. What about waiting for some Arab state to separate from the Soviets? Well, of course, the major Arab state is Saudi Arabia, and he would have had to wait a long time for Saudi Arabia to separate from the Soviets for a logical reason. Namely, Saudi Arabia had no relations whatsoever with the Soviets. In fact, never in their history had they ever had any diplomatic relations with the Soviets. So therefore, for them to dissociate from the Soviets would have been a tricky matter. And in fact, quite apart from Egypt, there's also the problem of Saudi Arabia. In fact, most of the other countries had no relations with the Soviets, couldn't dissociate from them. Kissinger's comment on the Russian commitment to what he calls the maximalist program of destroying Israel, that's equally amazing. The fact is that the USSR was clearly and explicitly on record with a commitment to the international consensus, which offered nothing to the Palestinians at that time, I should say, and was explicitly committed to guaranteeing Israel's security. In fact, the Soviet Union repeatedly made offers, statements, you know, offers to participate in a force that would guarantee Israel security and so on. But Kissinger couldn't understand it at the time. And more remarkably, 10 years later, it still hadn't penetrated the clouds. In fact, this should be looked at carefully. It's kind of a remarkable fact about our political culture, I think, that Kissinger's reputation is able to survive all of this. I mean, you know, this is imbecilic. I mean, there's no other word for it. It's a degree of ignorance that's you can't imagine. You know, it's hard to imagine what you're just sort of, you know, stupefied. But what is interesting is that it doesn't matter. There is no political commentator in the United States, none of his academic colleagues, who are undoubtedly aware of all of this and completely appalled by it, but none of them will comment on it. None of them will comment on the incredible stupidity and ignorance of the memoirs or on the events themselves, that is, on Kissinger's role in bringing about the war and the oil crisis and so on. I think this has to be regarded as an indication of the tremendous fear and awe of power in academic circles. Kissinger is a man associated with power, so therefore you keep quiet. I mean, you may poke around a little about trivialities, but you don't bring out what really went on or what the man really is. Well, he's an academic. It's not only his academic colleagues who respect him so highly. On March 14th of this year, Kissinger was honored by B'nai B'rith with their International Statesman Award. That's, again, he's not the only one to have achieved such awards. For example, Gene Kirkpatrick was given the Golda Meir Human Relations Award by the women's branch of the U.S. labor Zionist movement. That was, again, March 1984. And a year earlier, she had been given the Simon Wiesenthal Humanitarian Award as April 83. So, you know, a lot of people are getting awards. But let's come back to that. After 1973, American policy did change. Kissinger sort of, you know, understood that he better recognize that Egypt exists. And he began a process which is called in the United States the peace process. It's universally called the peace process. It ended up with the Camp David Accords. And if you look, you'll discover that without exception, across the board, these are called the peace process in the United States. Well, there's a few questions that one might ask. So you'd imagine that some commentator might ask the question what the people in the occupied territories think about the peace process. Well, there's an answer to that. Israeli-run polls have given an answer. They show that they overwhelmingly describe the peace process as harmful to their interests. In fact, about 2% of them, according to Israeli-run polls, think of the peace process as beneficial to their interests. Now, that might cause some pause in a country that had a free press. That is, you might, some journalists, one, let's say, across the country, might ask, how come the people in the occupied territories, the indigenous population in the occupied territories, regards the peace process almost unanimously as detrimental to their interests? How can it be a peace process if this is true? Well, in fact, a very easy answer to why they have this conclusion, if anybody bothered to think. What was the peace process? Well, what the peace process was, consummated in the Camp David Accords, was a system whereby Egypt was excluded from the conflict. The major Arab military force was excluded from the conflict. So therefore, Israel would be free, with U.S. funding and support, to carry out the policies that we knew perfectly well it was going to carry out if we paid for them, namely settlement in the occupied territories and attacking its northern neighbors. As long as the United States is willing to pay Israel to build settlements in the occupied territories, as we do, it will, of course, build them. And the American aid program is designed to guarantee that this is the result, I should say. American aid program to Israel is not only colossal in scale, in fact incomparable to any other one, but also unique in that it's apparently the only aid program which has no supervision. See, other countries, you know, aid is supervised down to the last dollar to make sure that they spend it on American wheat and things like that. In Israel, it's given without supervision and with no conditions. That's a way of telling Israel, we're paying you to do what you say you're going to do. You say you're going to build settlements, we're paying you to do that. American aid is designed to ensure that it will be used for settlements in the occupied territories. That's the way it's constructed and designed. Of course, if we get a so-called peace process in which Egypt is eliminated from the conflict, so there's no deterrent, because that's the only major Arab military force, and we then proceed to pay Israel to plead with it virtually, to put settlements in the occupied territories by paying for them. And we also pay Israel to attack its northern neighbors, because that's, again, what we pay them for, with giving the money with no strings attached. Then, of course, that's exactly what they'll do. I mean, any other country in similar circumstances would do the same thing. And that's what the peace process meant. The peace process was simply a system, predictably, incidentally, perfectly predictably, and predicted at the time, outside of the mainstream of the American media, where you couldn't talk about it and still can't talk about it, though now it's obvious in retrospect, at least. I mean, it was obvious at the time. You'd think it'd be obvious in retrospect, but it's still not possible to speak about it. But the meaning of the peace process and the reason why the population in the occupied territories is strongly opposed to the so-called peace process is that by eliminating Egypt from the conflict, eliminating the deterrent, combining that with payment, direct payment to Israel, virtually asking them to build settlements in the occupied territories by eliminating any conditions and so on, and to attack their northern neighbors, then that's exactly what will happen. And, of course, it is exactly what happened. As soon as the peace process was put into effect, the settlement and repression in the occupied territories extended enormously, and Israel began to attack its northern neighbors. Because, as they say, you know, there was no deterrent anymore. So in 1978, Israel invaded Lebanon. A couple of thousand people were killed. About 250,000 refugees were caused. It's Operation Litani. In 1979, Israel bombed Lebanon extensively. Again, this is not regarded as terrorism in the United States. Continued in 1980. In June 1981, Israel again broke a ceasefire, bombing Lebanon. It led to some exchanges and ended up with 450 Arabs and six Israelis killed. The Habib ceasefire was put into effect, and at that point Israel started the plans for the 1982 invasion, which I've already described. That's the peace process. That's what's universally called the peace process in the United States. Again, a remarkable fact about the nature of American political discourse. I'll come back to the peace movement. Well, as I said, the invasion of Lebanon was supported by the United States all the way through mid-September, through the invasion of West Beirut. The attitude of the administration, the American administration, towards that invasion is expressed, for example, by the following statement from our leader on October 28th, when he referred to the 10,000 Palestinians who were bringing ruin down on Beirut. You know, that's an expression of such moral cowardice. I mean, it's as if the Germans talked about the British who were bringing ruin down on London during the Second World War or something like that. I mean, you know, that's again, unspeakable. You kind of want to have a talk about it. It defies comment. And it defied comment in the American press. Nobody thought it was worth mentioning. The Democratic opposition throughout the war was even more supportive of the Israeli war than the Republicans were. The left wing of the Democratic Party was, in fact, the most grotesque of all. The Santa Monica City Council, which is regarded as virtually a Bolshevik cell, they passed a resolution supporting the invasion and another resolution condemning the appointment of George Shultz, who they were afraid would not be sufficiently slavish in his support for Israel. And they opposed this in the middle of the invasion, in the middle of the bombing of Beirut, you know, when Beirut's being smashed and everybody's looking at it on television. The Santa Monica City Council passed a resolution condemning the appointment of Shultz, quote, at this grave moment in Israel's existence. Right? Well, while the Israeli Air Force is bombing Beirut with no, you know, not with perfectly, you know, nobody's shooting at them. I mean, they have total command of the air, you know, artillery bombardment, aerial bombardment. At this grave moment in Israel's existence, not the existence of the Palestinians, you know, whose society was wiped out in the south and whose refugee camps were destroyed, at that moment we have to be concerned about Israel's existence. Well, that tells you something about the peace movement. Meanwhile, Tom Hayden and Jane Fonda were standing on the hills above Beirut admiring the slaughter and urging the Israeli army on to attack Beirut to complete the conquest. That's the left, you know. In the course of the invasion of Lebanon, Israel attacked Syria. This was, again, completely the Syrians. We have a good record of this from the Israeli military historian Zev Schiff, who's the top military historian and has written about this, and it's also discussed in my book on the base of his columns. Israel attacked Syria unprovoked. Syria didn't expect to be attacked. In fact, they hadn't even called a mobilization. They hadn't even filed. While Israel was attacked, they assumed that Israel was just going to try to destroy the Palestinians. So the Syrian troops were sort of on the side. You know, they're waiting. They didn't even fire an air defense missile when Israeli bombers were flying over the place. In fact, they didn't even call a mobilization until they were directly attacked. The Israeli soldiers attacking the Syrians didn't even meet returning artillery fire. But Syria was attacked, setting up a confrontation with the Russians because it's a Russian ally. A lot of Russian advisors were killed. According to Aviation Week and Space Technology, which is usually pretty authoritative, about 200 Russian advisors were killed by Israeli bombing. Israel bombed the Russian embassy repeatedly, shelled and bombed the Russian embassy. It finally occupied the Russian embassy partially for 2 days. Well, you might ask yourself how the United States would have reacted under comparable circumstances. Say if a Cuban army invaded Costa Rica, let's say, killing a couple hundred Americans, shelling the American embassy, taking over the American embassy. I won't proceed. Anyway, the Russians didn't react, fortunately, so we're still around here to talk about it. In the subsequent period, up till the last few weeks, in fact, U.S. military forces were involved, which are, again, in the United States, universally called peacekeeping forces, were in Lebanon. The so-called peacekeeping forces, in fact, were backing one side in a civil war, and by much, probably most of the population, they were regarded as an occupying army. We call the actions against this occupying army terrorism. But, of course, for much of the population, it's heroic resistance against an occupying army. The so-called peacekeeping forces were there in support of one element in a civil war. In fact, they were there to try to consummate what Israel called the new order that they hoped to establish in Lebanon, namely the rule of right-wing Christian groups associated with the Flange and some associated Muslim privileged sectors, their rule over the rest of the population. And our Marines were in there to try to bring that about. That, incidentally, is our natural stance in world affairs just about anywhere, so it's not too surprising that it was true there. What is perhaps of some interest is that nobody in the press could raise the question of whether these were peacekeeping forces and whether the actions against them were terrorism or just heroic resistance against part of an army of occupation that was trying to impose the rule of privileged right-wing groups over the mass of the population, which is, in fact, what they were, certainly the way they were seen by much, if not most, of the population. Well, again, that's the typical blindness. There was an enormous American task force, naval task force in the region, right in the eastern Mediterranean, a huge Russian fleet. 7,000 Russians were manning defensive missiles in Syria. That's a result of the Israeli attack on Syria. It would be quite an understatement to say that the situation was explosive. There's a brief respite because, fortunately for the world, the American effort in Lebanon collapsed, but it's sure to recur. It's sure to recur, so the respite is very brief. Well, let's look at American policy. During this period, current American policy basically has four elements to it. Two of them go way back, two are current. One element is what's called strategic cooperation with Israel. That is, according to this, Israel is regarded as a strategic asset which can defend American interests in the region, people who threaten those interests, and perform various subsidiary services throughout the world, support for Mobutu in Zaire and for various dictators in the Southern Cone and for dictators in Latin America and in Central America and so on. It's been particularly important since 1977 because of the congressional human rights restrictions. So that's strategic cooperation. The second major, I'll talk about it, it's history in a moment. The second major principle is support for the militarization of Israel and support for its takeover of the occupied territories and later its takeover of southern Lebanon, for which we pay every step of the way, both the occupation, the settlement, the extension to southern Lebanon, and so on. This has been operative American policy since 1970, since Kissinger took over. The third policy to which we are now theoretically committed is the Reagan plan, which I'll talk about in a minute, and the fourth is the now aborted peace plan for Lebanon, which we can call the Shultz plan. Now, if you look at these four policies, the first two fall together, strategic cooperation and support for the militarization of Israel. Those two fall together. They're real policies. Those are things we really support. The other two, the Reagan plan and the Shultz plan, they also fall together. They should be regarded as comparable to the kinds of proposals that are made at disarmament meetings. That is, they're meant to fail. Their purpose is to fail, but to quiet the domestic population by making it look as if you're trying to do something. So the Reagan plan and the Shultz plan were designed to fail, unpredictably did fail, but that's just rhetoric anyway. The real program, unchanging, is strategic cooperation and support for the militarization of Israel. Now, let me comment briefly on that. The strategic cooperation program, that's gone through I'll just quickly trace the evolution. As I mentioned before, in the early 1950s, the United States had not yet settled on who was going to be. The American interest in the Middle East is obvious. It's oil. That's basically the only interest. By the mid-40s, it was already understood that these are the most extensive and cheapest reserves of energy in the world, and whoever controls them is going to have a major role in controlling world affairs, and therefore the United States has to control them. That was set by the mid-40s. The question is, how do we do it? Well, we do it by having some regional, part of the way we do it is by having some regional power that can beat back any threat to our control over oil. Now, in rhetoric, the threat is Russia, but of course that's nonsense. The real threat is an indigenous threat, what we call radical Arab nationalism. Now, the term radical in American political rhetoric means any action that's opposed to the interests of the American government. It can be conservative, it can be anything, but that's radical. So what would be opposed to the interests of the American government would be any attempt on the part of the Arabs to take over control of their own resources. So that's radical Arab nationalism, and that has to be beaten back, and we need somebody to help us do it, so the question is who it's going to be. Well, in the early 50s, it wasn't clear. They thought it could be Nasser. And in fact, as I said, Nasser had CIA support. By the late 50s, this had already been pretty much resolved. It was going to be Israel. A National Security Council memorandum in 1958 notes that a logical corollary of American of opposition to radical Arab nationalism would be support for Israel as the only loyal, trustworthy state in the region. And in 1958, the United States sponsored a then-secret, since public, pact called a Periphery Pact, which included Israel, Ethiopia, Iran, and Turkey, a pact to surround the region with a set of loyal, militarized states. In the 1960s, American intelligence regarded Israel as a barrier to radical nationalist pressure. That meant, at the time, Nasserist pressure from Egypt against the oil-producing regions. In 1967 war, Israel demonstrated its capacity to dominate the region by force, and American aid shot up. And incidentally, that's when the love affair of the American left with Israel really began, when Israel demonstrated its enormous military capacity, its capacity to smash and destroy everybody in sight. The American left kind of very impressed by that and liked it. And that's when the love affair started. We go into the reasons, but it certainly happened. In the late 70s, this continued under the Nixon. Remember, there was the Nixon Doctrine in the early 1970s, stated that it was the position that the United States no longer had the capacity to run the whole world by military force directly. We had to have surrogate states, as Kissinger put it. We had to have regional powers which could control their own area within the overall framework of order managed by the United States. Okay. Police headquarters stays in Washington, but the local cop on the beat can be somebody else. That's what it amounted to. And in the Middle East, the surrogates, American surrogates, were to be Iran under the Shah and Israel. And Israel, again, showed its significance in this role in 1970 when it threatened to intervene to prevent the Syrians from supporting the Palestinians who were being massacred in Jordan. American aid to Israel shot up by a large factor after that. And so it continued, to make matters brief. When the Shah fell in 1979, Israel was left as the only surrogate state. So therefore, again, American aid to Israel shot up. You know, the huge aid has been since 70, when the Shah was already tottering, up until today. That's when the huge increase in military aid went. All of this makes sense on certain assumptions, namely on the assumption that we need a dependable, militarized client state which will be able to protect our interests against any threat, primarily against indigenous threats. That is, the threat of people to take control of their own lives. That's what we've got to defend ourselves against, as elsewhere in the world, incidentally. Well, that's the strategic cooperation. That's the main element in strategic cooperation. The minor elephant is the one that I already mentioned, the subsidiary services, penetration of Black Africa. The United States used Israel as a way of supplying oil to Rhodesia, to evade the UN embargo and various other things of that sort, primarily now in Latin America. It's another story. That's principle one, strategic cooperation, and roughly the way it's evolved. Support for Israeli militarization and its occupation of the takeover of the occupied territories, southern Lebanon, I've discussed that briefly. Let's take a look at the Reagan plan. The Reagan plan, that's an interesting case. The Reagan plan was announced on September 1st, 1982, that is, after the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, after the bombing of Beirut. The Reagan plan called for, it's not very clear what it called for, some kind of settlement. No Palestinian state, no role for the PLO. That means it was kind of analogous to a proposal that some anti-Semite might have made in 1947, saying, well, yes, we can have a settlement in what was then Palestine, but no role for the Zionist organization and no Jewish state. so the Jews can have self-determination as long as there's no role for the Zionist organization. You can imagine a proposal like that in 1947, made, let's say, by some Nazi or something. That would be analogous to the Reagan plan, because as Reagan and everybody else knew, the Palestinians in the occupied territories and elsewhere in every possible way have designated the PLO as their representative, and it certainly has as much legitimacy as the Zionist organization had in 1947. So that was the Reagan plan. Nevertheless, Israel rejected it totally, immediately and totally. The Arabs had various mixed reactions, interest but not exact acceptance, saying, including the PLO, saying, let's go on. Now, how did the United States react? In fact, what was part of the Reagan plan was a call for a freeze on settlements. Well, Israel announced the day after the Reagan plan, it announced that it was going to vastly increase settlements. That was its response to the Reagan plan. It also had another response to the Reagan plan. Israeli troops violated the ceasefire, which had just been established, under which the PLO had left Beirut, just left the day before, in fact. They violated the ceasefire on September 3rd and sent their troops towards Sabra and Shatila and establishing observation posts over the camps. That also happened the day after the ceasefire, after the Reagan plan was announced. But the major thing which was immediately noticed was this announcement that they were going to vastly increase settlements in defiance of Reagan's request that they freeze settlements. Now, the interesting question is, what was the American reaction? What Jordan and other Arabs pointed out is, well, let's see how the Americans react to this. Then we'll know if the Reagan plan is serious. And they quickly found out what the Reagan plan meant, because Reagan's immediate reaction to this was to call for an increase in the already phenomenal level of aid to Israel. Now, the Democratic opposition thought this wasn't enough, so they called for a still further increase. This was in mid-September. So in other words, this was after the Sabra Shatila massacre. So what Reagan was saying to the Israelis, and they understood, they're not stupid, is this: after you have invaded Lebanon, after the bombing of West Beirut, after the Sabra Shatila massacres, after your explicit and open brazen rejection of the Reagan plan and its call for the freezing of settlements, we therefore reward you by increasing the already phenomenal level of aid. In other words, right on, folks. And the Democrats thought that wasn't enough, so we have to give them even more. Okay. Now, the way this was described in American journalism is kind of intriguing. The Reagan proposal to reward Israel by increasing the huge subsidy was called punishing Israel in the American, or politicizing the aid process. Reagan was criticized for politicizing the aid process by only giving Israel a further increase in the phenomenal level of aid in thanks for its achievements in rejecting the Reagan plan and increasing settlements and bombing Beirut and carrying and organizing the Sabra Shatila thing. That's punitive. That's punishing Israel. The Democratic opposition, of course, that was not politicizing it, and they made a compromise. That's the way politics works. They picked something in between. Well, the obvious meaning of all of this is that the Reagan plan was killed by the Reagan administration within days. It was stone dead within a couple of days because the Reagan administration killed it. Well, that's not the way history can read, of course. What history has to say is that this statesmanlike and wise effort by President Reagan, in keeping with the traditional American commitment to peace and self-determination, was blocked by the unfortunate and traditional refusal of the Arabs to have any, et cetera, et cetera. The rest of the story. And it took 3 or 4 months for the official story, for the proper story to get established, but by about February or March, that's what the editorials were saying. It was a little difficult that time. It took about 4 months to get the correct history written, but that's the way it was. The real history, on the other hand, as distinct from the party line, is what I just described. Reagan killed the Reagan plan within days, and it was finished, period. That's as clear an indication as there could be that the Reagan plan was never intended seriously for a moment. As I said, it's like proposals at the disarmament meetings. It's meant for the domestic population to shut them up, like elections in El Salvador or something like that. Shut up the domestic population. Meanwhile, we can go on doing what we want, killing people in El Salvador, supporting Israeli settlements in the occupied territories and so on. What about the Shultz plan for Lebanon? That was the plan announced on May 17, 1983, which in effect put southern Lebanon under a high degree of Israeli control. That plan was forced down the throats of the Lebanese government. They described it as necessary surgery. They said they couldn't do anything about it. Necessary surgery, that's the way they defended it, because in effect it left southern Lebanon under the control of an Israeli client, the Israeli territorial forces there. Syria was pointedly excluded from the negotiations. pointedly excluded in the certain knowledge that therefore Syria was going to reject them. I mean, if the Soviet Union had entered and had made an agreement between, you know, elements in Lebanon and Syria and had then turned to Israel and say, okay, that's the settlement, now you guys get out, of course Israel wouldn't have paid any attention. Right? Similarly, it was obvious that Syria was not going to pay any attention, and it didn't. That was, again, a plan that was designed for failure, specifically designed to fail, and of course it did fail. Later, the American press began saying, well, isn't it odd that we didn't bring Syria in and, you know, overlooked something, our typical naivete, and so on. It was completely and perfectly obvious, discussed in advance, you know, predicted in advance, everything, except in the American press, which couldn't discuss it, and in fact, in retrospect, still can't. Now, was there an alternative? Of course there was an alternative. Again, not discussed here, but obvious. Syrian forces were in Lebanon under a 6-year Arab League mandate. They had been called in originally by the Christians in Lebanon to block the PLO. Their entry had been supported by Israel and supported by the, at least tacitly supported by Israel, openly supported by the United States. And they had a 6-year mandate. They were to clear out in the summer of 1982. Well, would they have left in the summer of 1982? Well, we can't know. That's an unanswerable question because the possibility was aborted, was eliminated by the Israeli attack. Obviously, after they were attacked by Israeli forces, that was finished. So we don't know if they would have withdrawn in summer of 82. A cynic might argue that this was one of the reasons for the timing of the Israeli invasion. But putting that aside, there was an obvious approach that the United States could have made. It could have called for Israel to withdraw immediately and unconditionally from Lebanon, in accordance with the wording of the UN Security Council resolution, which the United States itself had supported on June 6, 1982. The principle would be that an aggressor has no rights. In fact, an aggressor should pay reparations. But putting that aside, an aggressor has no rights, can't demand anything. So therefore, Israel should do just what the United States said it should do when it supported that resolution, withdraw immediately and forthwith and unconditionally. That's the unconditionally and forthwith was the wording. That's what they could have called for. With regard to Syria, they could have proposed that Syria should have withdrawn in accordance with its with what had been planned for 82, for mid-82, but aborted by the Israeli invasion. It's very likely that that would have worked. To make it even more likely that it would have worked, the United States could have responded to the request of the right-wing Christian government that had been put in place under Israeli guns. Their request was that that we bring the Russians into the negotiations. They didn't say that because they love the Russians. They don't. But because they're Lebanese nationalists, whatever else you think about them. The Lebanese nationalists, and they knew that the only way to get Lebanon free of foreign troops was to get the superpowers to agree on it. It's the only way to get anything done in the world, except by violence. So therefore, the right-wing Jamal government asked the United States to bring the Russians into the negotiations, the theory being that the Russians would put pressure on their ally Syria to withdraw, and the United States would put pressure on its ally Israel to withdraw. Well, the United States didn't want to have any of that because we didn't want peace. What we wanted was continued confrontation. And therefore, this alternative was rejected, and the press was sufficiently loyal to keep quiet about it and remain so to this day. Well, those are the four major proposals. Now sorry to drag on a bit, but if you have enough patience, let me turn to the main topic, and I'll be briefer about this. How has the peace movement reacted to all of this? Well, I've discussed it a little bit. The main reaction is quick. We can discuss it very quickly. It's been silence. In the late 1960s and the early 1970s, the peace movement and the American left basically supported the Labor Party and kept a low profile. The Labor Party was, of course, busily beginning the settlements and beginning to take over the territories and carrying out repressive actions and so on. The Sadat proposals in 1971, you'll search in vain for any response here, peace movement or whatever. When Sadat finally did launch a war in 73, he was attacked by the peace movement and others for his unprovoked resort to violence. Then the peace movement supported the so-called peace process, and it provided no analysis of it, though it was entirely obvious what it meant. In the 1976 peace proposal, that was silenced and suppressed by the peace movement as much as by anyone else, and that's continued to be the case. There's been a whole series of Arab initiatives of one sort or another, all suppressed by the peace movement, just as support is suppressed by everyone else. The most recent attempt to solve the conflict was in January 1984. This was a United Nations initiative late January 1984, the United Nations called for a conference which would be attended by Israel, the PLO, the neighboring Arab states, and the members of the Security Council, hence a general conference to try to bring a peace. And everybody knows what the terms of that peace have to be. They have to be a two-state settlement with recognized borders and so on and so forth, along the lines of the vetoed 1976 resolution, which is supported by virtually the whole world, I should say, out of the United States and Israel, outside of them. The United States refused to participate in the January meeting. Gene Kirkpatrick said that announced the United States would under no circumstances participate in this meeting, and that was dead. Again, I don't even think this was reported here. Nor was it picked up by the peace movement. So, again, we have the same situation as always. U.S.-Israeli rejectionism, silence in the media, distortion in the media, essentially the same reaction in peace movement circles. One of the great scandals during this period was in 1982, June 1982, at the huge disarmament meeting in New York. That was a couple of weeks after I was here. You remember there were, 700,000 or some huge number of people showed up in New York to demonstrate against nuclear war. Well, at that huge peace demonstration took place immediately about a week after the Lebanon invasion, which brought the world close to nuclear war. There was no mention of it, not by accident. It was a decision not to mention it. That, again, shows something about the priorities and the seriousness of the peace movement. There were people who did talk about it. For example, Hassan Tweny, the UN, the Lebanon ambassador. And let me mention who he is. He's a right-wing Lebanese Christian, the owner of Lebanon's major newspaper, An-Nahar. The Jamal government, in fact, designated him as the person in charge of the negotiation process. In other words, a right-wing conservative Christian. He was the UN ambassador, exactly the kind of guy we're supposed to like, in other words, in the United States in 1982 when the invasion took place. He's the one who I quoted earlier. And in fact, in late June of that year, he pointed out in a speech at the United Nations Disarmament Conference that the Israeli invasion was bringing the world close to nuclear war. He pointed it out. He also added something else. He said that the atomic holocaust of tomorrow becomes a problematic danger, remote and almost unreal, to those who are living an actual holocaust, the holocaust of their mother earth, of men, women, and children physically destroyed, along with the cities they built and loved. He, incidentally, was the representative of the country that was being liberated, according to the New York Times. And it's interesting that his name does not appear in the New York Times files during this period. He made many statements of that kind, but since the principle was, the ideological principle was that country was being liberated, obviously you can't quote its right-wing Christian representative who says that it's being attacked and destroyed. So therefore you don't mention him at all. And in fact, if you check the New York Times files, you'll find that his name does not appear. He was a couple of blocks away from the New York Times editorial offices. Well, maybe that's not so surprising. What is perhaps surprising is that there was no response in the peace movement. Take a look at the American peace movement. You'll see that there, too, there was no response. In fact, what I'm quoting from is an English-language journal published in Tel Aviv. One has to go to Tel Aviv to find out what the representative of Lebanon was saying in an office a couple of blocks away from the New York Times editorial offices and right where the peace movement offices are in New York. That tells us something. One might say the same about the solidarity movements, which until quite recently have been unwilling to... they've been keeping very silent about the crucial role that Israel has played as an American client in supporting a series of Guatemalan Himmlers and people like Mobutu and Zaire and Idi Amin for a while and so on and so forth, Pinochet, Argentine generals, and so on. Pretty much the same is true with regard to repression inside Israel or in the occupied territories, which we pay for, remember. It's not something happening out there. It's something that we pay for. It happens because we pay for it. So it's we're the ones who are doing it, basically, our clients. When the Palestinians, for example, attempted nonviolent protest in the West Bank or in the Gaza Strip or in the Golan Heights recently, there was no response that I could find from the advocates of nonviolence here. They were silent about it, namely the ones who were paying for it, for paying for the repression and the breaking up of these nonviolent protests. In 1972, under the Labor government, Israel forcefully evacuated several thousand farmers from northeastern Sinai, Egyptian territory. That was part of the background for the 73 war. Quite brutally, they were expelled into the desert. Their villages were destroyed by bulldozers. The mosques were destroyed. The cemeteries were ripped up. The orchards were destroyed, the whole thing. And an Israeli settlement was built there, the town of Yamit, designed primarily for American and Russian immigrants. Not a word from the peace movement, except things like, say Irving Howe giving awed comments about Israel's unique magnificence and so on and so forth. So apart from that, there was no response from the peace movement. And there are many other similar incidents. There was an anti-Arafat rebellion in the PLO recently, you remember, in Fatah. And part of the reason for it was the belief that Arafat's commitment to negotiations had failed. So Arafat had offered the olive branch, and it had failed, so let's go to the gun. The conclusion that was drawn was that the United States and Israel are simply committed to violence. They will not accept any peaceful settlement, and therefore there's no alternative other than armed struggle. Well, you know, I don't think that's right, but it's certainly understandable. And the people who are responsible for that decision, and who now deplore, you know, the Palestinian return to armed struggle, or parts of them, the ones who are responsible for that are the people who did not respond to the peaceful initiatives. You don't respond to peaceful initiatives and diplomatic efforts, and you can be sure that oppressed people are going to turn to violence. You don't leave them any alternative. And that's what the United States has done in this case, and the peace movement in the forefront. All of this, I should say, has been quite successfully obscured here. Time being short, I won't go on with the whole story. Briefly, let me say something about perceptions of the peace movement. These are kind of interesting. One interesting sort of perception is given by Nathan Perlmutter in an important book. He's the national director of the Anti-Defamation League. The Anti-Defamation League is regarded here as a civil rights organization. In Israel, they regard it as, I'm quoting, one of the main pillars of Israeli propaganda. And when a journal like Haaretz refers to the Anti-Defamation League, as it did in a recent article, it refers to it as the strangely named Anti-Defamation League. That is, they have to explain why an organization which is plainly related to Israel the way the Communist Party is related to Russia, they have to explain why it has this funny name, Anti-Defamation League, and they explain, well, you know, 20 years ago it used to be concerned with civil rights issues or something. So Nathan Perlmutter, who's the national director of the Anti-Defamation League, which incidentally undoubtedly has one or more spies in this audience taking notes, I recently had leaked to me from one of their offices my file at the Anti-Defamation League, which was just from the New England office alone. I don't know what they have in the national office, but in the New England office it was 150 pages, mostly, a lot of it surveillance. You know, every little talk I give, somebody's out there sending notes back to the central office. This is being done under a you're paying for this, incidentally, so am I, because it's being done under a tax-free organization acting as under a grant as an educational and religious organization. It's under those conditions that it carries out surveillance, distributes defamatory material, attempts to, you know, vilify opponents of the Holy State, and in fact acts essentially the way the Communist Party acts with respect to Russia, or would if it had enough power. Well, the national director, so whoever's taking notes, make sure you get that down straight. The national director of the, and I'm going to check, because the next time I get leaks from the office, I'm going to look and see if you got it straight. The national director of the Anti-Defamation League, Nathan Perlmutter, he had an interesting book. It's called The Real Anti-Semitism in America. You should really look at it. It's very, very interesting. So who are the real anti-Semites? He says, well, the real anti-Semites are the critics of the United States in Vietnam, the critics of the arms race, the critics of the United States in Central America. Those are the real anti-Semites. He says that, I'll quote now, he says, the actions of the peacemakers of Vietnam vintage, the transmuters of swords into plowshares, champions of the terrorist PLO, the forces that now who say that war is those are the real anti-Semites. And then he expresses his fear, I'll quote it. He fears that, quote, nowadays war is getting a bad name and peace too favorable a press. That's a memorable phrase. War is getting a bad name and peace too favorable a press. And we've got to watch out for that, because that's anti-Semitism. When peace gets too favorable a press and war gets a bad name, or people criticize American policy in Central America, that's the real anti-Semitism. That's the message of the book. And it's understandable. It's not crazy, you know. If you assume that the interests of Jews are the interests of an expansionist, militaristic Israel, and if that's what the interests of Jews are, then, of course, anybody who acts against the interests of an expansionist, militaristic Israel is an anti-Semite. He's against the interests of Jews. That's the logic, okay? And a powerful United States with lots of missiles and, you know, killing people in El Salvador and so on is in a better position to support an expansionist, militarist Israel. So therefore, if you're opposed, if you are giving war a bad name and peace too favorable a press, you're an anti-Semite. A lot of anti-Semites under that definition. Well, that has a certain, that underlying that is a certain concept of Israel, what Israel ought to be, a concept shared by the Anti-Defamation League, incidentally, and by many mainstream American Jewish organizations. The concept of Israel that they have in mind is, it's interesting to see the way it's described by Israeli doves, who are rarely heard here. Let me quote one, a mainstream establishment figure in this case, Meir Pa'il, who's a military historian and former director of the War College in Israel, a reserve colonel in the army, and a former parliamentarian. He describes this concept of Israel held by the Anti-Defamation League and others. He says that it's leading to a... He says it's going to construct an Israel which is a compound of the racist state structure of South Africa and the violent, terror-ridden social fabric of Northern Ireland, a cruel and non-democratic state structure with constant internal fighting and bloodshed. That's the concept of Israel that he perceives accurately is supported by groups of the kind that I've just mentioned. He speaks of what he calls the idolatrous cult worship of a Jewish fortress state among American Jewish groups. He says the principal source of pride for many diaspora Jews has become the enormous military might that Israel wields. The Jews have transferred, speaking of the diaspora Jews, have transformed the state of Israel into a war god similar to Mars, a violent apartheid state. He says this is an original contribution to the annals of 21st century political science, a unique kind of Jewish state that will be a cause for shame for every Jew wherever he may be, not only in the present but in the future as well. Now, he is describing the concept of Israel held by people who call themselves its supporters. He's not inaccurate in that. Anti-Defamation League, for example. And he pleads virtually that people who call themselves supporters of Israel will, he says, they have a historic task. Their historic task, he says, is quite different. Let me read you. He says, American Jewry bears a historical obligation to wage a forceful political struggle, including economic pressures, to save Israel, to prevent the Zionist enterprise from being transformed into a fanatic movement that will doom itself to extinction. Now, there are two different concepts of Israel. Okay, it's not a matter of supporting Israel or not. It's a question of what you mean when you're supporting Israel. The Israel that's supported by the Anti-Defamation League, and pretty much by the peace movement, I should say, is a warrior state like Mars. That's what it means to, for example, say we ought to keep giving aid in support of settlements in the occupied territories. That's what it means to say we have to keep paying Israel to build settlements in the occupied territories, which is what we're doing and what we will do unless constraints are put on it, or we must pay them to take over southern Lebanon and attack their neighbors, which is what we're doing, is to guarantee that we will have what Meir Pa'il describes. Well, what has happened over all this period, I'll finish right now, is that the United States has set conditions which Israel has accepted, which have led to the construction of a certain kind of Israel, namely a pariah state, the world's most militarized state, a state that's completely dependent on the United States. It barely has an economy at this point. It's the most heavily subsidized state in the world. It's the most militarized state in the world, has the highest per capita debt in the world. It's rated by international lending organizations as being literally at about the level of Bangladesh in reliability, even with the American support. If the American support disappeared, we go even lower. And the United States has been more than pleased to see this happen. The United States has been more than pleased to acquire a kind of a militarized dependency, technologically advanced, very effective in the use of force, a kind of Sparta, an international pariah. That's crucial because we want it to be dependent, you know, hence dependable, and therefore able to support narrowly conceived American interests in the region itself, and elsewhere to carry out the kinds of actions that very few can endure, such as support for Guatemalan genocide. For Israel, this has been a moral disaster. It's also an economic disaster, and sooner or later it's going to be a physical disaster as well, because this means constant military confrontation and sooner or later destruction, almost certainly. For millions of people, suffering people in the Middle East and elsewhere in the world, it's been a catastrophe, one that they have to live every day of their tortured and brutalized lives. For the rest of us, what it means is a constant risk of superpower confrontation and a very strong likelihood of eventual nuclear war. And to a degree that most of us here, I guess most of us would regard ourselves as part of the peace movement, or I would imagine so, to a degree that people like that, us, that we should regard as deeply troubling, the peace movement has played quite an essential role in ensuring that all of this will come to be. Okay, I'll try to start over here. Well, fight it out. Yeah, right. Well, I didn't have time, that's all. The question was that last time I was here in May 82, I suggested that one of the reasons for the forthcoming Israeli invasion, which I didn't know it then, but took place 2 weeks later, would be to get control of the waters of the Litani. What about that? Well, there has been some investigation of that since, not much. ABC News did a study of the Israeli operations in South Lebanon, the water operations. The head office decided not to run it, so it was never run over ABC News. But the head of ABC News, John Cooley, did write a long article about it in the Washington Post, this suppressed series, and he described the beginnings of what looked like water projects in the South. There have been a couple of other reports. There was one in the Christian Science Monitor, in fact, a few weeks ago. My impression is that it will happen sooner or later, but it's starting slowly. There's just too much visibility at the moment. And in fact, the real focus for the water problems now, and this also relates to a possible forthcoming war, I hate to appear and keep predicting wars, especially if they're going to keep coming, but another possible one is with Jordan, and this could be because of the water projects at the northern end of what's called the East Gore Canal. The Yarmouk River, which comes in from Jordan into, you know, meets the Jordan River, there were American plans way back to try to arrange for water rights for the various states. Israel has insisted, in effect, in taking 100% of it. In fact, a lot of the conflict around Syria and Jordan has to do with Israeli efforts to take over the water. This goes way back to early 1950s. What's happened recently is that Jordan built a canal on the east side of the Jordan, the East Gore Canal it's called, which is used for irrigation and farming and so on, relatively rich farming areas. The Israeli conquest in 67 put Israel in a position where it can block work at the northern end of the canal. Now, the northern end of the canal is getting silted up. You know, silt is accumulating. Apparently, it would take a bulldozer about 15 minutes or so to clear away the silt, but Israel has not permitted Jordanian bulldozers to clear away the silt, which means that the water that would be going to the canal is now getting diverted directly into Israel because it's not going into the canal. This is pretty serious. It's particularly serious this year because there's a serious drought there. And the Jordanian Ministry of Agriculture recently informed Jordanians in the Jordan River that they can't plant this year because there's no water. And it's going to get worse every year. And this is another possible flashpoint for a war. Water in that region is very significant. Israel is using its own water resources to 100% capacity and technically more than 100%. That is, their seepage, saline seepage in from the sea because they're using it so fast. And about a third, at least, of Israeli water comes from the West Bank right now, which is probably the main reason they don't want to give the territory back. The conquest of the Golan Heights was largely a matter of trying to get control of the headwaters of the Jordan. And Israeli operations since have continued in that direction. This goes way back, I don't want to go through the whole history, but it goes back to the early 50s. So, I would guess sooner or later we're going to read about hydrological projects that interrelate the Litani River to the national water carrier in Israel. Do it ourselves. Yeah. Look, I understand. Look, it doesn't make sense. The question was, you know, when will the scholars and the artists and the intellectuals and so on create alternative media which tell the truth about some of these things? And the answer is never. You have to recognize that the intelligentsia are part of the privileged sector of the society. And you can therefore only, social science is a very simple field. Everything's trivial and obvious, basically. You just have to think a little bit. And if you think a little bit, you recognize that, people who, you can make complexities and there's sort of tenth order effects, but the main things are pretty obvious. One of the main things is that people who are privileged are going to support privilege. You know, that's pretty obvious. And the intelligentsia, at least, you know, those who have access to any, in the universities and so on, they're quite privileged. We're all quite privileged. You know, we're the upper tiny element of American society in terms of actual wealth, in terms of prestige, in terms of access to power, you know, if you like that kind of thing and so on. And it's only to be expected that in any society, the mainstream of the intelligentsia will be quite supportive of external power. And that's always the case, you know. So you can't expect them to change. Why should they, you know? What you can do is construct mass popular organizations which create their own media, you know, their own intellectual, which make everybody educated, therefore they don't need a class of privileged intelligentsia to come and tell them, you know, the party line and so on. And that's pretty much, that's happened, you know. That's happened. I mean, that's what the movement was in the 60s. It had its own media, you know. It had its own activities, its own mode of communication, it had large-scale participation. Incidentally, that also affected the mainstream media to some extent. It even affected the universities to some extent. They began to open up a little bit, not much. But that's the way to do it. It's through popular organization, not for waiting for somebody to, you know, change their skin for some reason, which I'm going to do. Yeah. Well, the anti-Arab racism in the United States is really something pretty frightening. In fact, there's plenty of racism in the country, but generally, racism is not officially accepted. That is, people won't come out and say, "I'm a racist." You know, only very marginal elements do that. We pretend, you know, everyone pretends they're not racist, and racism is officially frowned upon, with one exception: anti-Arab racism, which is not only accepted, but it's honored, kind of. So, for example, take Gary Hart. I mean, Gary Hart literally stated that his campaign manager stated that he withdrew his money from a bank in Washington or wherever it was because they discovered that it had Arab owners. Well, imagine that somebody said that some political candidate said he withdrew his money from a bank because he found that it had Jewish owners or black owners, you know. That'd be inconceivable, you know. But if a person, I mean, maybe they'd do it, but they wouldn't say so, you know. And they wouldn't say so with pride, with great pride, and expect to be applauded for it. But that was done. So this straight, overt racism was applauded. I mean, that showed that he's a really good guy. And you can multiply that over 1,000 times. I mean, you just see it in the cartoons in the press. I mean, the caricatures of Arabs that appear in the press, if any other racial group, or ethnic groups, not racial, any ethnic group or whatever, were subjected to that kind of caricature, we'd be talking about the Nazis, you know. That's what we would be talking about. But this is done standardly across the board. Now, there are places where it's carried to an extreme. I mean, there are journals which are reminiscent of Der Stürmer, you know, the Nazi journals in this respect. For example, the New Republic. I'm quite serious. This has even been commented on in the press. Christopher Hitchens, for example, who I think Masao mentioned in his most recent column in The Nation, comments on an astonishing column that appeared by the editor of The New Republic, Martin Peretz, in which he described Arabs in general, I forget the exact words, something like crazed fanatics or something like that. Elsewhere, The New Republic has talked about, has said that you can't trust Arab reports of atrocities because, in their words, because Arabs lie, or because there's a trait in Arab culture that makes truth irrelevant, you know, or something like, things like, I mean, this appears in the mainstream Journal of American Liberalism, you know. And as I say, that's, I mean, that kind of reminiscent of the Nazis, that kind of racism. Not the Nazis in the early 40s, but the Nazis in the 30s, that's what it's reminiscent of. And we might remember, incidentally, in that respect, some things about the Nazis. You know, one question that we all ask ourselves is, how were the Nazis capable of it? You know, how could they carry out a massacre of 6 million people, you know, high technology, mass destruction of a whole people, and many others, you know, millions of others, Russians, Gypsies, and so on. How could they do it? Civilized, educated people, in fact, people not very different from us. How could they do it? Well, one interesting thing to think about that is what the attitude of the Nazis was towards the Holocaust. Now, there's an interesting book about that, incidentally. It's called Warrant for Genocide by Norman Cohn. It came out about 15 years ago, I think. And in it, there were, in fact, some analyses of support for the Holocaust, you know, for the anti-Jewish actions in the 30s and the Final Solution in the 40s, support for it among the German population and among the Nazis, Poles at the time and so on. And the polls are kind of revealing. For example, it turns out that in 1938, I may have the numbers slightly wrong, but I think it's roughly like this. In 1938, in the Nazi Party itself, not the German population as a whole, but the Nazi Party itself, something like, I think, 5% supported, this is 1938, supported Hitler's anti-Semitic actions, and about 70% were, I think the word was, outraged by Hitler's anti-Semitic actions. That's in the Nazi Party itself, you know, means in the German population as a whole, even a smaller percent supported them. In 1942, when the Final Solution was already underway, you know, extermination camps and so on, there were other studies which showed pretty much the same figures. They showed about 5% of the Nazis who supported the actions against the Jews, and they supported them, incidentally, as defense. They said the Nazi ideology was that we have to use terror against terror. That was their, see, the Jews are carrying out terrorism. They're, you know, they're taking over the world and carrying out terrorism against Germans, and therefore we have to defend ourselves, so we're entitled to use terror. That was the Nazi line. And about 5%, sound familiar, about 5% supported it, and about 70% were kind of passive, you know, didn't have any attitude. And that's what it took, you know. It took a tiny group, in the face of general passivity, it took a tiny group of fanatics to carry out something like the Final Solution. One should bear that in mind in thinking about how it could happen and in considering our own situation. And the anti-Arab racism is something not to be considered lightly in this respect. Let's take somebody over there.
Dr. Chomsky, you give a very genial view of Israel's neighbors in your presentation, and you typify the United States, in fact, in being only one of the democracies to be circle hegemonism active in the area, each of which calls itself peace-loving. Certainly, Mr. President Richard Yanko would refer to Warsaw Pact countries as the great peace-loving peoples of the world.
Right. Well, the analogy that you draw between the World Peace Council and the Anti-Defamation League is very appropriate. In fact, I think I may have said something. The World Peace Council, if you don't know, is a sort of a communist front organization, you know, which it's very much upset about peace, you know, about American atrocities in Central America, but somehow it hasn't noticed, say, Russian behavior in Eastern Europe. That's very much like, for example, there's a group called American Professors for Peace in the Middle East. And that group is interested in peace in the Middle East in the same sense in which the World Peace Council is interested in peace in Afghanistan. So that analogy is quite appropriate. The point was that there are other forms of hegemonism in the region. I take it you're referring to the Soviet Union?
Or?
Yeah. Okay, Libya's attack on... Well, okay, there we have to be a little careful. I mean, first of all, the extent... the Soviet Union in the region has been very defensive, has been quite passive, by and large. In fact, the Soviet Union has never made a move towards the central American interests, namely control of... The main American interest in the region is Saudi Arabian oil. In fact, the oil of the Arabian Peninsula. And the Soviet Union has never made a move near that. And they know, and it's not because they're nice people, certainly not, but they know that as soon as they even look in that direction, the world's going to blow up, you know, because the United States will never tolerate any move, even not by the Europeans, not by the Arabs, not by the Europeans, certainly not by the Soviet Union, towards this major interest. So the Russian position in the region has been, in fact, you know, again, not because they're nice people. They're not, within the regions of their control, they're vicious. But their reach is much less than we pretend. Okay, so their reach does extend to Eastern Europe. In fact, it extends to the regions conquered by the Red Army during the Second World War from Hitler. And it now is in Afghanistan, a complicated story. But basically, that's it. In the Middle East, the Russians have been essentially defensive. So it takes Syria today. They've given Syria plenty of arms, but they're not the kind of arms which would permit a Syrian attack. You know, in the case of Egypt, when that was a Russian client, they essentially gave Egypt defensive weapons, which were not enough. You know, even the Egyptian War of 1973 was apparently a limited operation intended to break the logjam, not expected to go very far, and the Russians didn't give them the materiel to be able to launch a major attack. That's, incidentally, pretty broad consensus, including Israeli specialists on the Soviet Union and American specialists and so on. I cite some literature, if you like. And that's to be expected. I mean, the Russians are not going to tamper with a region of Central American concern any more than the United States is going to tamper with Eastern Europe. I mean, we used to try, you know. Like in the early 1950s, the United States, well, the late 40s, certainly, maybe even the early 50s, but certainly in the late 40s, the United States was supporting armies in the Ukraine that were established by Hitler, because we were still hoping at that time to be able to break Russia up from within. So we were supporting, in fact, Hitler's armies established in the Ukraine. The CIA was giving them airdrops and so on. As far as I know, that hasn't happened past at least the early 50s. So there's been a sort of we also tried in Albania and so on, but by the early 50s, that was sort of settled, and certainly the Russians, who were much the weaker partner, were not going to tamper with a major American region. That's, in fact, why in the late 40s, the first major American counterinsurgency campaign after the Second World War was in Greece, and the purpose was to destroy the anti-Nazi resistance, which was worker and peasant-based, and to restore the Nazi collaborators in Greece. That's what we call liberating Greece under the Truman Doctrine. That's what it was. In fact, that was typical throughout the world, but Greece was a particularly striking case. And in fact, we organized a major counterinsurgency campaign, a major war in Greece, kind of a model for El Salvador and Vietnam, which was literally aimed at destroying the worker and peasant-based anti-Nazi resistance and reinstating the Nazis. That's what it was aimed at. The people we were supporting, like King Paul and Queen Frederica, they came out of the Hitler Youth Movement. And the Minister of the Interior, which in a European country means running the police and so on, he was a Nazi. You know? That's what we were supporting, and we won that one. The Russians never got involved. Or to be more precise, the Russian involvement was to try to call off the Greek guerrillas. And the reason was because they knew that the United States regarded Greece as a part of the periphery of the Middle East, and therefore they can't tamper with it. So in fact, Russian hegemonism, the word you used, is... doesn't extend to the Middle East. I mean, no doubt they'd like to have it if they could, but they know that the only way that they can even come near that area is by provoking a nuclear war. Well, Afghanistan is a kind of separate case. I mean, Afghanistan was more or less ceded to Russian control decades ago, Russian influence. Now, in the 70s, a rather complex situation took place. There were coups and so on and so forth. The major intelligence agencies were jockeying with one another for control over Afghanistan, including the Iranian one under the Shah working for the United States, the Americans and the Russians, and the whole complex sort of business. In April 1978, it got resolved in favor of the Russians. And they made there was a sort of a pro-Russian coup. In other words, they started carrying out reforms which aroused violent opposition on the part of the feudal tribesmen. Their investment in Afghanistan was beginning to erode. Russian military were being murdered, and so on and so forth. And they then invaded. Nobody could justify that invasion. At least, you could compare it with the American invasion of Vietnam, I think, and I have. But it doesn't indicate any expansionist tendency of a general nature, I don't think. I think that's a misreading. And I believe that that's the general consensus of non-fanatics. I mean, people are really trying to analyze it. So as far as Libya is concerned, you know, Libya plays a very special role in American demonology. You therefore have to be... You have to be very caught. I mean, there's no doubt that, you know, there's plenty of terrorism coming out of Libya. Like, they kill off Libyan dissidents, they do all kind of ugly things. But it doesn't follow from that, say, that they try to invade Chad. In fact, what happened in Chad is, again, complex. You know, there's been a... I mean, there's no time to go through the whole story, but Chad is... the least country in the world, I guess. It's very hard to call it a country. It's a group of tribes, very backward, very impoverished. There's been a lot of fighting going on. The French have been in there with their, you know, with their agents, and the Libyans have been there with their agents, and they shift up, and sometimes they're on the same side, sometimes they're on opposite sides. But it's a kind of, it's a tribal warfare which is a consequence of the imperialist, it's a consequence of the imperialist conquest of Africa, which hasn't been resolved, like many. And the Libyan role is mixed, you know. To call it hegemonism is a vast exaggeration, I would say. In the Arab world itself, I mean, the country, I haven't talked about the Arab countries, but, well, there's nothing nice that you say about any of them. I mean, Syria, for example, is one of the most violent terrorist regimes in the world, you know, but it doesn't happen to be aggressive. You know? Now, maybe it would like to be, but it isn't, you know, for objective reasons. There's virtually no correlation between the internal nature of some country and its commitment to external violence. And I think if you look back over history, you'll never find a correlation back to the Greeks. Okay. If you couldn't hear, he gave a number of examples of anti-Arab racism in the left. Some of them I don't know about. They're things that happened here. Demonstrations. For example, he said that there was a demonstration here in, was it June 12th, 1982, where there was a Palestinian speaker who was booed by a sort of progressive crowd. I mean, if that's true, it's really, I mean, mind-boggling. You know, this is, I wasn't here, so I don't know. But, okay. I mean, that's really, really shameful. I mean, here's a representative of people who are really being decimated by a major military power supported by the United States, and the person is booed. I mean, that's unbelievable. But the second example was the, which I do know about, was the decision of the Coalition for a New Foreign and Military Policy, which is sort of coalition of progressive kind of liberal groups, which did, in fact, exclude the Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, which is a bona fide civil liberties group. It's certainly, it's like what the Anti-Defamation League used to be like decades ago. It's a real civil libertarian group. The leading figure in it is Jim Abaresque, who was had the best record of anybody in Congress when he was a senator, and its stands have been right along the lines of the coalition from the beginning. It was excluded because it's an Arab group. The deciding vote against it was apparently that of the New Jewish Agenda, so it appears. That's very ugly. That's very ugly. The third case, I forgot what it was. But the general question was, what's the reason for the attitude of the left and, you know, the peace movement or whatever towards Israel? Well, there are a number of answers that could be given. The sort of shallowest answer, but one that is correct, is that there is so much, this is going to require a further explanation, but let's take it a step at a time. Given the enormous support for Israel on the part of the whole spectrum of American liberalism, any of the solidarity groups or peace movement groups and so on have felt that if they don't go along with the most chauvinistic and really ultimately destructive policies, they're going to lose their own support. So many groups have just kept silent about the issue because they don't want to lose their own support. That's undoubtedly the case. I don't have this. I mean, I know for a fact that that's the case. I won't mention any groups. But many of them have decided they're simply not going to raise this issue because they're going to lose their support. So therefore, they'll keep quiet about it, or they'll go along with the mainstream and so on. However, this still doesn't answer the question why the enormous support for Israel on the part of the whole general spectrum of American liberalism. Why that? Well, that's more complicated, and here I think you've got to go a little deeper. First of all, let me say that you know, each individual may have their own reasons. Individuals have their own reasons. You can't, you know, whatever they are. But when there are large-scale tendencies, you can look for an explanation of the tendency. And there are some very notable facts about this. One notable fact is that the attitude of American liberalism towards Israel shifted radically in 1967, left liberalism. So, for example, say take a journal like Dissent. You mentioned the Democratic Socialists. That's their journal. Dissent was a non-Zionist or even anti-Zionist journal until 1967. After 1967, it's been the kind of journal that Mayor Payul was talking about in those comments I quoted. The role of people like Irving Howe or Michael Walzer, leading Democratic Socialist gurus, has been just like that of the Communist Party towards the Soviet Union. So, you know, vilification and denunciation of anybody who dares to say that there's some, you know, minor flaw in the Holy State and so on and so forth. I should say the Israeli press recognizes this. Here there's a big pretense that these people are dissidents. But in the Israeli press, what you read, for example, is that, Irving Howe finally did write a mildly critical article about Israel in, I think, April 1982 or so. And there was an article in the Israeli press about this, in the mainstream press, a journal called Kol Ha'ir, which is another kind of mainstream journal. And they wrote that something terrible has happened, and in America, you know, the Israeli ambassador came back with an article from the latest New York Times, and here was something by Irving Howe, I'm quoting now, criticizing the state he loves, you know. And then it went on to say, Irving Howe is no ordinary lover of Israel. It said, when everybody has deserted Israel, Irving Howe will still be waving the blue and white flag. So that's a real, but even he has begun to criticize Israel. And then it says, Begin, who else will you lose for us or something? It's a Labor Party kernel. So that's the way they look at the big spokesman for the Democratic Socialists. Well, okay, that's maybe a little ironic and exaggerated, but the picture is approximately correct. So, for example, when Dan Berrigan, back around, 1970, dared to point out some of the facts about repression and of Arabs and so on and so forth, Irving Howe launched a vicious attack of the kind he remembers from his days as a Trotskyite, and that kind of stuff has been going on for a long time. Now, that all was since 1967. It was not true pre-67. You can check that. In fact, pre-67, Howe, to take him since I mentioned him, called himself a non-Zionist. Now he calls himself an ardent Zionist. That's his phrase. And pretty much the same is true of Michael Walzer and others. Now, what happened in 1967? And incidentally, you could find many other examples of this. I mean, there was support for Israel, plenty of it before, but it shifted radically in 67. Now, here you have to try to explain what happened. As I say, each individual might have had their own reasons, but it's such an obvious tendency that you have to explain what happened. And I think what happened is essentially this. This is interpretation. Up till now, it's been fact, so let's label it. My interpretation would be the following, that it's first point to understand is that most of these people were fundamentally in support of the American war in Vietnam. I mean, they didn't like the way it was going, you know. And they thought maybe it's getting too bloody or something like that. But basically, they supported it. So, for example, Dissent, again, the Journal of the Democratic Socialists, in 1964, supported American troops in Vietnam. They said, yeah, American troops should stay in Vietnam. That means they supported the American invasion of South Vietnam. That's like some Russian supporting Russian troops in Afghanistan. Now, that was their position. They never changed it. At the end of the war, they said, yeah, it was right, except maybe for nuances. So fundamentally, they were in favor of the war in Vietnam, and they didn't like the fact that the United States wasn't winning. That's one crucial fact. Another crucial fact is that many of these people, these are privileged people. Many of them were people who had recently attained privilege, who had been, in fact, political activists and who had now made it and become big professors and so on and so forth. And just when that happened, obedience began to collapse in the universities. You know, remember, that's what was going on in the 60s. Students were asking questions. You know, they were insisting on answers. I mean, they weren't just sort of copying down what they were told, you know, doing some independent thinking. I mean, all these horrible things were happening. There was a real challenge to authority. There's a pretense now that they were burning libraries and that sort of thing. That's all fabrication. I mean, what was really going on was that there was a challenge to authority. You know, that's what was really happening. Furthermore, there was this kind of crisis of democracy I was talking about. That is, groups were organizing elsewhere, like ethnic groups. Say, you know, first black groups began to seriously organize and make a bid for power, political power. That just began to happen then, and they began to threaten vested interests. And in fact, you know, there was this picture in the minds of a substantial segment of the privileged elite. There was this kind of amalgam, you know, of Viet Cong, who we can't defeat. I mean, Black Panthers who are shooting at us. You know, students who are burning down libraries. PLO terrorists. I mean, all kind of one big, you know, third world amalgam that's threatening our power and privilege. And the United States is trying to beat them in Vietnam, but we're not succeeding. Then all of a sudden Israel comes along and really shows how to treat third world upstarts properly, you know, really smash them in the face and do it right, you know. Now, at that time, if you remember back, there were all kind of sort of semi-jokes going around about how we ought to get Moshe Dayan and send him to Vietnam and he'd do the job right. Well, those weren't jokes. You know, they were not jokes. Here, somebody really showed how to, you know, handle these upstarts and do it right, smash them in the face. On the other hand, if you're a liberal, humanist, and so on and so forth, you can't publicly be in favor of smashing people in the face. So what you have to be in favor of the victim, right? And here Israel played a unique role. It was capable of presenting itself as the victim when it was obviously the major military force in the region. Now that's quite unique. That meant it was possible to adopt your usual stance of supporting the victim of aggression, you know, the little victim, David, and so on, when the victim turned from smashing every army in the region to suppressing and oppressing its own population within. Now, that's a kind of a unique contribution. It's hard to find something like that, as neat as that. I think that this probably accounts for the huge flow of enthusiasm for the mailed fist, really, because it was able to present itself as somehow victimized. Hence, it was possible to be, you know, in favor of violence and power, which you really are in favor of, while pretending to be in favor of the miserable victim who can barely sustain himself and so on. Hence the suppression. This is a big part of it, I think. Now, there are other parts. You might compare this with your own experience and so on and so forth, because this is interpretation, of course. Another element of it, which I think is pretty clear, is that it was discovered very quickly that it was going to be possible to defame the peace movement and the student movement and undermine them by pretending that they were in favor of terrorism against Israel. See, the fact of the matter is that the peace movement, journals like, say, Ramparts and Liberal, I actually wrote an article about this once in which I went through the record, you know, of the peace movement journals like Ramparts and Liberation, and without exception, they were dovish Zionist. Literally without exception, sort of supporting the Labor Party. But the dovish Zionist. But that's exactly the case. There was not one exception. I'll give you, I know some heads nodding, I'll give you some documentation if you like. It's in print. The pretense that was constructed about these journals is that they were supporting you know, PLO terrorists who wanted to kill all the Jews and drive them into the sea. Now, that fabrication was concocted by people like Seymour Martin Lipset and Irving Howe and various others. And it was pure lies, you know, pure fabrication and lies. You can check it out for yourself. Go back and read the issues of those journals. I actually reviewed all issues in the article that I'm talking about, but that was true without exception of the major journals of the New Left, like Ramparts and Liberation and Peacework and so on and so forth. It's not true of some of the Marxist-Leninist sects, you know, but I'm talking about the journals of the New Left. Now, one of the ways of trying to defame and undermine the New Left, and in particular the student movement, which most of these people hated because it really was challenging authority, was to pretend that they were terrorists. So you read articles by Irving Howe in which he talks about how, you know, the thing that pains him more than anything else is seeing Jewish students collecting money for Fatah. I can't imagine that that ever happened. I mean, I was really involved in the peace movement. He wasn't. I never heard of a Jewish student collecting money for Fatah in 1970. And he doesn't, of course, never refers to anything. See, part of the technique of Stalinist-style vilification is that you never need facts. You just make charges. Or he has, you know, satirical articles in which he talks about how, in fact, he's an amazing article which appeared in the New York Times in which he talked about how the only way that Israel, he said, will ever win back favor in the New Left is if it it carries out a bloody fascist coup. And then he says the youth from, you know, Palo Alto and so on will be rushing to Israel to pay it, you know, to pay their love, show their love for the maximal leader. And he says Jean-Paul Sartre will go to Israel and write a 1,000-page book on how wonderful the new fascist coup is and so on and so forth. I mean, that's really Stalinist-style lies. In fact, just at the time that he was writing that, Sartre was given an award from the Hebrew University for his support for Israel. He was, in fact, a big Zionist. Now, but that didn't matter. As I say, facts are irrelevant in this kind of stuff. And as far as the New Left is concerned, as I said, it was essentially dovish Zionist. But this was used as a very effective technique of vilification, and there are many people now totally ignorant of the New Left who know about it only from secondary sources, you know, from reading the propaganda that was concocted, who assume that, yeah, that's what it really was. And there were people like, for example, Lipset, who just lied flat outright about this and knew they were doing it. I've got material in print about this, which I can direct you to if you want to check it. There's no question that this is the case. Okay. I don't want to. Well, all right. I mean, he said democratic socialist, so, yeah, okay. Look, the left isn't a membership organization either. Somebody's on the left if they call themselves on the left. Well, who's the left in your sense? Who's the left in your sense? Well, who do you mean by the left? Well, who do you mean by the left? I told you who I meant by it. Well, who? Who? Okay, who? No, like, you know, organizations or whatever. Well, who? Okay. The Marxist-Leninist left, yeah, right. That's the Marxist-Leninist left. By the liberals and the left, yeah. Yeah, I understand. Now, I'm not misleading them. The question was specifically about the democratic socialists, okay? All right, I don't want to argue about whether they're on the left or not. There's no definition of, you know, the left is, you can't, this is just a pointless discussion. I mean, if somebody wants to call themselves left, okay. I don't even know what the word left means, frankly. A lot of the people who call themselves left, I would regard as proto-fascists. But if you mean by the, if you're referring to the Marxist-Leninist groups, true, they were pro-Palestinian and anti-Israel. If you're referring to the Vietnam Day Committee and the other anti-Vietnam groups, they were not particularly left. Who? Okay, but just saying the real left groups doesn't help me. You know. Oh, the Communist Party, right. The Marxist-Leninist left is, I was not discussing. Okay, yeah. Well, who then? Okay. I think we've exhausted the... Well, somebody who says that Israel has a right to take over the land because it has a higher technological level, I mean, I don't know who that guy is, you didn't mention him, but such a person, let's say, is, you know, we understand that position. That's the standard colonialist position. That's why we got to kill off the Indians in the United States, and that's why the British had to take over India, and so on and so forth. The higher technology just has a right to own everything. Well, okay, there's no discussing with that. That's like... You know, by that, I mean, it's, again, that's not very dissimilar from the Nazi argument. They were the higher race, and therefore it was better for everyone if they took over. Just as an irrelevant matter of fact, the Jordanian agriculture is very high level, in fact. Oh, that's irrelevant. I mean, you know, I mean, 'cause I don't accept the principle that the higher technology has a right to take over, but just for the record, Jordanian agriculture has been quite effective. That kind of view, I think that's probably prevalent only among kind of technocratic segments. It's not my impression that that's a widely prevalent view in Israel, but I may be wrong. I didn't say that. I was talking about us. Yeah. Go to Lebanon? Well, the PLO didn't attack Lebanon. Well, how did the Palestinians get to Lebanon? Did they go there because they liked the scenery? Yeah, they... Okay, they were driven there, you know. Well, okay, so what happened to... Yeah. I made that? No, I didn't say anything. In fact, you know, I said Nasser was supported by the CIA. And so on. That's largely true. Well, I talked about the Russian support for Syria, and I said it's essentially defensive. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Okay, look, I know this litany. We can go through listing the massacres back to day one, but I didn't look. I understand. Okay, could you formulate your point clearly and then I'll... A lot of other problems in the region, yeah. Undoubtedly, yeah.
My question is, do you think that the Israelis were the ones to cause the eruption in Lebanon?
The 1975 war?
Right.
Yeah. Well, okay, let's look at that specific question.
And also, were they the ones that assassinated Bashir Gemayel?
I haven't the slightest idea who assassinated Gemayel. Nobody else does. But that's an answer. That's a question we'll never know the answer to, incidentally. But it was obviously somebody who was on the inside. That's pretty clear. But who it was, we don't know. The question, the more general question, let's talk about that one, was what about the various conflicts in Lebanon in the 1970s and what was the Israeli role and the Palestinian role and so on and so forth? Well, the rough story is this. It's a complicated issue, and, you know, I won't be able to give all the nuances, but roughly it went like this. The Palestinians were in Lebanon because they were driven out of what was Palestine and then driven out of Jordan. That's why they're in Lebanon. In Lebanon, they did establish a sort of a relatively self-sufficient community. In the early 70s, under the Cairo Agreement, which Lebanon agreed to, they were carrying out cross-border activities against Israel. That pretty much ended by about 73 or 74. Yeah. I mean, the Christians in Lebanon certainly didn't want it. Look, Lebanon is not a Christian country. Look, Yeah, it was a Christian country because of an imperialist. Right, the imperialist powers left Lebanon as a, in fact, Lebanon in the modern, look, okay, look, in the, I mean, I don't know how far back you want to go. I was starting in 1970. You want to go back further. Lebanon in its current form was carved out by France as part of a post-First World War imperial settlement, and its boundaries were adjusted with all sorts of conflicts between the British and so on and so forth in such a way as to guarantee the Christians, who the French really supported, control over the largely Muslim areas in the south. They wanted it to be big enough so the dominant Christian groups would be able to control a big population. Then in 1943, there was this so-called National Pact was formed, which essentially gave the Christians dominance under the fabrication that they were the majority group, which they weren't. By about, this broke down pretty quickly. By the late 50s, this was already collapsing. It was clear that the Christians were a minority group. By now, they're a relatively small minority group. And furthermore, among the Christians, there are a lot of conflicts. Like the Falange is what we usually refer to when we're talking about the Christians. The Falange, which is a subgroup of the Maronites, which is a subgroup of the Christians, you know, they are a small minority. Look, the rest of the Christian... look, but the Armenians played a different role and the Greek Orthodox played a different role. I mean, Lebanon is a real complex patchwork. Now, I'm not being prejudiced. I'm describing... What am I being one-sided? I'm just describing the facts. Now, those facts are correct, right? Okay, now let's... No, they're not complete, of course. To make it complete, we have to go on for 5 hours or 10 hours. But I want to point out the general outline. All right, let's not go through ancient history and just ask what happened in the 70s. In the 70s, under the Cairo Agreement, the Palestinians did carry out cross-border operations. Israel carried out heavy attacks in southern Lebanon. By about 1975, about 300,000 southern Lebanese, mostly Shiite Muslims, were driven out of southern Lebanon, and much of the country was laid waste. By the time that the Lebanon Civil War broke out in 75, there were, according to the Lebanese government, the right-wing Christian Lebanese government, Israeli provocations were running, I think, at about 17 a day. You know, that's the level at about 1975. Now, in 1975, the Civil War broke out. The PLO had essentially nothing to do with it, except that they were killed. The first major act of the first major action of the thing that really, and there was lots of conflicts going on, you know, way back to pre-biblical times, but, you know, we don't want to talk about that. In the modern period, starting around the mid-70s, the Civil War essentially broke out with the attack on a bus by right-wing Christians, by Christian phalangists in April 75, in which 28 Palestinians were murdered. That was the first major act of the Civil War. Palestinians really did, and then started conflicts between Muslims and Christians, a very messy business. You can't describe it simply. But roughly speaking, there was a sort of a Lebanese national movement, which was largely Muslim. It had Christian elements too. And there was a largely Maronite movement, which was, you know, which we call the right-wing Christians. It's more complicated than that, but that's first approximation. The right-wing I'll call it that. The right-wing Christian groups attacked they carried out the initial attacks. First major attack was the bus attack. This was a bus that was going from between, I forget which way, from Sabra Shatila and Tel al-Zatar to Palestinian camps, and I think about 28 Palestinians were murdered. That was the attack that set it off. Then there started acts and counteracts and so on and so forth, most of them Christian massacres. The biggest Christian massacres were in December 75 and January 76, somebody said Carantina, which probably had about 1,000 people killed, roughly, Palestinians. Up until that point, the Palestinians were really trying to back off. They wanted to stay out of the Lebanese civil war for obvious reasons. You know, they didn't want to get entangled in Lebanon's internal problems. However, they were giving some support, defensive support, to the Muslim groups who were being attacked by the Falange. That was happening through the 75. They were carrying out, as far as anybody knows, no aggressive attacks of their own through 75. After the Carantina massacre, which, like I say, about 1,000 people killed, the PLO did take a response. Namely, they carried out a massacre in Damour. Now, according to the Israeli military, which has no reason to minimize this, Western correspondents agree, the number of people killed in Damour was about 250. That's a massacre, right? And that was a response to the roughly 1,000 people killed by the Maronites in the Falange massacre of the Carantina slums. Now, Western history begins with Damour. Okay, you take a look at the standard American histories, or take a look at the Kahan Commission report, you know, fabled report of the Kahan Commission. It starts with Damour. That was the first thing that happened, you know, Palestinian atrocity. what really happened is what I just described. It was at the end of a long series of Christian atrocities, which were much worse. Okay, that doesn't justify Damour, but tells you what happened. Now, after that, a real civil war, you know, a big civil war broke out with the Palestinians siding with the mainly Shiite, also Sunni, mainly with the Muslim groups. They were beginning to win, and the Christians called on the Syrians to intervene. This was mid-76. The Christians called on the Syrians to intervene. They did intervene. The United States backed them. Israel plainly, at least tacitly, backed them. And they intervened against the Palestinians and against the Muslim groups. Okay, it was during this period that the Tal al-Zatar massacre was carried out, the biggest massacre, with a couple thousand Palestinians killed by the Falange. Throughout this period, there were close connections between Israel and the Falange. We know that for certain that they go back to early 75, and in fact, if you trace it back, these really go back to the early 40s and the early 30s. I mean, here are two small groups, right-wing Christians and Jews, both of whom felt like minorities in the Middle East, and they thought maybe they'd make an alliance. That's the original thing. But it really blossomed in the mid-70s. Now, Syria intervened in 76. The framework of the Syrian intervention after Syrian troops were already there became the Arab Peacekeeping Force under an Arab League mandate. They later turned and they began to support they began to fight against the Falange and support the Lebanese Muslim groups. That was a split, a shift. And that's the way it went on. You know, the main civil war was about 75, 76. Incidentally, there's a lot of exaggeration about what happened. The civil war was bad enough, but it wasn't as bad as people claim, according to reputable sources. The claims here, the numbers that you hear here, are that about 100,000 people were killed. And the way it's usually put is the PLO killed 100,000 people. Well, the fact of the matter is that probably about three-quarters of the people killed were Palestinians and Muslim. And furthermore, according to the London Economist, which is good on this, quite good and fairly expert, the actual numbers killed were probably about 25,000, most of them Palestinians and Muslims. You know, bad enough, but not what's presented here. And that then sort of simmered down by about 76, 77. There were a lot of, in fact, after that time, there were conflicts among the Maronites. So, for example, the Falange got control of the Maronites by massacring their opponents, you know, massacring Shamunists and the Frangia and so on and so forth. That's the way the Falange got control of the Maronite community. During this time, there were occasional efforts which looked as if they might work, you know, to bring about some sort of a compromise. You asked about Israel's role. There are a number of times when Israel did take initiatives which apparently were aimed to break up the possibility of compromise. One was after the Shtar Accord in 1977. I won't go on to further details, but if you want to look, you know, take a look at, say, Walid Khalidi's history or something like that, there's a lot of detail in it. I think that's pretty much what happened. Now, as far as there was a lot of propaganda in the United States after the Lebanon War about PLO atrocities in the South. There was also investigation of that fact by Israelis, and that was very interesting. It was never reported here. The most interesting study of it was carried out by an Israeli Arab named Atala Mansour, and his reporting is particularly interesting because he's a Maronite. He's an Israeli Arab Maronite. Okay, he traveled through Lebanon looking for a PLO, you know, condition to find PLO atrocities against the Maronites. And he wrote a long article in Hebrew. I discuss it in my book. It's the only source in English. It was never discussed here. But that's surely the most authoritative report that was written about this topic. He's a highly respected Israeli journalist, a Christian Arab Maronite, in fact. And what he wrote is that he says that he went through the areas that were under Palestinian control, and he says it was harsh. You know, they were sometimes, you know, high-handed and so on. He said, but there's very little in the way of real atrocities, very little. And in fact, his Maronite, you know, he had family all through there who, you know, his cousins and all this thing. They told him, look, it's mostly fabricated by the politicians. He said, life was no bed of roses. It wasn't pleasant. It was tough. The Palestinians were, you know, harsh sometimes, but there weren't sort of rapes and murders and this kind of thing, very rarely. Now, then he went to the Maronite-controlled areas, and he said, well, in those areas there were no atrocities against Palestinians for the very simple reason that they were all either killed or driven out. There were none left. You know. He furthermore says that this was largely true of the Muslims, too, that most of the Muslims were essentially driven out of the Maronite-controlled areas, so there were no atrocities there. On the contrary, he says that he discovered traveling through the Muslim-controlled areas and the Palestinian-controlled areas that there were flourishing Maronite communities. you know, living more or less, not easily, but, you know, living. There was nothing like that in the Maronite-controlled areas. And that's not too surprising, because the sort of what we call the leftist Muslim coalition, you know, the sort of involving the Shiite, Amal, and so on, and the Palestinians, it was basically secularist. It was basically nationalist and secularist. Whereas the Maronites are a rather fanatic religious group, you know, who see themselves as an embattled element in a Muslim world, and they got to hold on to their, you know, they got to hold on to their power and defend themselves against everybody else. You can understand it, but that's the fact. And the result was that in the Maronite-controlled areas, you don't find Muslims and Palestinians because they were driven out or killed or something. Whereas in the Palestinian and Muslim-controlled areas, there were Maronite communities living not easily, you know, but without brutal atrocities. Incidentally, this was confirmed even in the English-language Israeli press by two Israeli correspondents, Benny Morris and somebody else, I forgot, who traveled through the area, again, looking for atrocities. You know, they were wanted to find PLO atrocities because that's, of course, what they needed at that point. This was in the middle of the war. And they said it just isn't true. They said they're mostly fabricated and they couldn't find them. Some of the worst ones they could find, like in Nabatea, they did find some PLO atrocities there, but they said most of the people who fled from Nabatea, I think it was, you know, 50,000 people or some huge number who fled because of Israeli bombing. Now, they never got to the Maronite areas, and they wouldn't have known what was going on there anyway, but Talal Mansour did. Now, all of this material has, I mean, the only place it appears in the United States is in this book of mine. Everybody in the press probably knew it, but again, that's not what you want to tell. And I think that's probably, to date at least, that's the most authoritative version that we have, I think, from these Israeli sources. One more question. Why don't you pick it so I won't be accused
of... Just one more.
You pick it.
Okay, how about you then?
Okay. Yeah.
And did Israel put Eliyahu in power? And this is a little more difficult.
That's four. Okay. Well, first, did Shamir collaborate with the Nazis? That's pretty clear. Shamir was head of a group which in 1941... He was one of the heads of a group which in 1941 did approach the Nazis. It approached them with an offer of collaboration, and it wasn't just, let's fight our enemy together, but they said, we agree with you. The statement, which has been public in Israel since 1974 and has just recently appeared in the United States in a book by Lenny Brenner, but you can find it in the standard Israeli sources, you know. It's discussed in Nathaniel and Moore's History of the Stern Gang, Lechi. It's discussed in dissertations in Israel. It was discussed extensively in the Hebrew press in early 1981. It's true that the group that Shamir, the current prime minister, supported, what's called here usually the Stern Gang, Lechi, was kind of an right-wing offshoot from the Irgun Tzvai Lumi that Begin ran. They approached the Nazis several times in 1941 with an offer to collaborate against the British, and they said that they agreed with the totalitarian philosophy of the Nazis and that they would be the outpost for the Nazis in the Middle East and that they would, you know, bring about a new order in the Middle East along Nazi lines and that they went on, the statement went on to say something about how this would help improve the image of the Nazis, you know, by association with Israel and so on. However, that's all true and not really questioned. But you got to be rather careful here. The fact is that nationalist groups all over the world were collaborating with fascists in those days. And there was a kind of a good reason for that. You know, the fascists, so for example, well, you know, say Sukarno in Indonesia was supporting the Japanese fascists. In fact, one of the things that the Nazis and the fascists in general were doing was upsetting the existing world order, right? It was an existing imperial world order. And the fascists and the Nazis were upsetting it. And they were often welcomed as liberators in the sense that they were upsetting colonial rule. Okay, that's also a factor that has to be borne in mind. So, you know, you had really funny alliances in those days. which are intelligible in terms of the assumptions for colonial people. Their main interest was not sort of whether the, you know, the British were going to kill the Germans or the Germans were going to kill the British. They didn't care much about that. They cared about their own liberation, you know. No, this is earlier. Post-war U.S. anti-colonialism? No, the U.S. got into the Middle East for a very simple reason. By the late 1930s, it was discovered that Saudi Arabia had huge resources of oil. A State Department evaluation in 1945, the words were like this. It said that Saudi Arabia is a stupendous strategic resource and the greatest material prize in world history. That's the way it was assessed by the State Department in 1945. And from then on, you know, there's no question about what the American attitude is going to be towards the Middle East. But, yeah. Not there. You know, what the U.S. was doing during the Second World War was trying to push the British out of the Middle East, not use the Nazis against them. See, there was a mini war going on inside the alliance. They were fighting the Nazis, of course, but meanwhile they were sort of jockeying for position for the future world. So, for example, the Western alliance as a whole wanted the main Nazi forces to be fighting the Russians, and they were. I forget the exact number, but I think something like 95% or something of the Nazi army was directed against the Russians, which is fine for us. It means they'll kill each other and we'll be there to pick up the pieces. Within the Western alliance, the United States wanted the British to be on the front line. So we wanted to keep the British in the war, so we're not on the front line. And in fact, Lend-Lease was arranged, you look at the legislation, it was arranged so that the British reserves would be enough to keep them in the war, but not enough for them to be able to hold on to their traditional positions. So during the Second World War, we were taking over British markets in Latin America. We were pushing the British out of the Middle East. And in fact, we were preparing to take over the British Empire. This is what is called, incidentally, anti-colonialism in American history. It is, literally. Take a look at the history books. It's called anti-colonialism, meaning we were using Britain's travail, you know, to essentially take over traditional British positions of power. France, too. France was a smaller empire, but we kicked France out of the Middle East and Latin America to some extent during this period as well. So that's part of the internal sort of jockeying for power. But as far as Shamir and the Nazis are concerned, yes, it's correct. And in fact, there was even support for totalitarian ideology. This was in 1941, remember. That's kind of late. In fact, I forget the exact date, but I think it was November 41 was the last time when Lehi sent an emissary through Turkey to try to convince the Nazis to make a deal. Nevertheless, before one sort of goes off on this, one has to recognize the context of the times and the relationship of various nationalisms to the Nazis and the fascists and so on and so forth.
What kind of deal was he proposing?
Specific? Yeah, he was proposing that Israel, that they would set up a Jewish state in Israel, which would be the outpost of Nazism in the Middle East. And it would follow the totalitarian model of the Nazis, which they approved of, and so on. You can get the exact wording in one of the appendices, I think, to Lenny Brenner's book, Zionism in the Age of the Dictators. I don't know. Well, it's a fact. I can't help it. Okay. Okay. Okay, if you think that it's false, take a look at the... You can find it in Lenny Brenner's book, which is quoted from a doctoral dissertation done at Bar-Ilan University in 1974. And you'll find exactly the same thing in Natan Yalin Moore's Hebrew History of Lehi, the sort of standard history. And if you want more sources from the Hebrew press, take a look at my book, which refers to articles by this guy, Beit Michael, who I mentioned, and others, who brought all the documentation out in the Hebrew press. Okay, fine. What? Well, okay. I gave you the sources. You can look them up and see if they're right. There's no point arguing that. Second question. What about Russia and Israel in the late 40s? There's no question about that. In 1948, Czechoslovakia, meaning, you know, Russia, was supplying Israel with its major arms. Now, there's some interesting stories there. You might take a look at Stephen Green's book, which brings up material from U.S. intelligence reports at the time. This is unevaluated intelligence, and you got to treat it as such, but here's what the intelligence report said. American intelligence speculated that Jewish members of the Western armies and people working for Israel were, in fact, stealing Western high technology radar and things like that, and giving them to the Russians as a quid pro quo for armaments shipments. Okay, that's possible. Anyway, that's what American intelligence was reporting. But there's no, that aside, there's no question that there's no question at all. You know, it's not even contested that the main arms flow for a while was coming from Eastern Europe. The United States had a, see, at that time it wasn't clear which way the Jewish state was going to go. In fact, American intelligence regarded it as possibly a dangerous Bolshevik cell. You know, it was sort of run by Eastern Europeans, you know, and a lot of them called themselves socialists or even Bolsheviks and so on and so forth. I mean, this is late 40s we're talking about. It looks different now. As far as Idi Amin is concerned, yes, Israel, along with Britain, were instrumental in putting Idi Amin into power. Idi Amin was an Israeli-trained paratrooper. He wore his Israeli paratroop things all the time, and this was part of the jockeying for power there. Yeah, they put him into power. He's not the only one. Bokassa, for example, Emperor Bokassa, sort of an Idi Amin type, was also supported by Israel. Haile Selassie was supported by Israel. After the coup, the Mengistu coup in Ethiopia, Israel continued to support the Marxist Mengistu until at least, I forget the exact date, but probably early 78. And what's more, they're supporting him again today, it turns out. They're very weird alliances there. I mean, one of the reasons why Israel would support, you know, the Marxist, Russian-supported Mengistu is because he's attacking the Eritreans, who are supported by the Arabs, you know. In fact, the alliance, you know, you really, I mean, we've been doing things with a broad brush. If you really look closely, there's some very strange things in the region. Take Iran. The current Iranian attack against Iraq is called Operation Conquest of Jerusalem or something like that. It's really aimed at Jerusalem. It's being supported by Israel, and it's being supported by Syria. You know, Israel and Syria are jointly supporting Iran's Operation Jerusalem against Iraq. Okay, if you sort of take it apart, you can kind of figure out what's going on, but it's not simple. And yes, Israel did support Idi Amin and many others. Mobutu is the major success story. If you want to call it success. Not success for the people of Zaire, but, you know, success for American policy. The last point I've forgotten already. Oh, yeah, who would we have left to fight? Well, who did we have left to fight? You know, we can always, just as we were fighting, I don't know if you were here for my afternoon talk, but I pointed out that when Wilson's Marines invaded the Dominican Republic, they said, in 1916 or whatever it was, they said they were fighting Germans, okay? Well, okay, you know, if that can sell, then you don't have to worry about finding enemies.